Chapter 7 Of Beginnings and the Names of Things. Sunlight poured into the waystone. It was a cool, fresh light, fitted for beginnings. It brushed past the miller as he set his water wheel turning for the day. It lit the forge the smith was rekindling after 4 days of cold metal work. It touched draft horses hitched to wagons and sickle blades glittering sharp and ready at the beginning of an autumn day. Inside the waystone, the light fell across Chronicler's face and touched a beginning there, a blank page waiting the first words of a story. The light flowed across the bar, scattered 1,000 tiny rainbow beginnings from the colored bottles, and climbed the wall toward the sword as if searching for one final beginning. But when the light touched the sword, there were no beginnings to be seen. In fact, the light the sword reflected was dull, burnished, and ages old. Looking at it, Chronicler remembered that though it was the beginning of a day, it was also late autumn and growing colder. The sword shone with the knowledge that dawn was a small beginning compared to the ending of a season, the ending of a year. Chronicler pulled his eyes away from the sword, aware that Kvothe had said something, but not knowing what. "I beg your pardon? How do people normally go about relating their stories?" Kvothe asked. Chronicler shrugged. "Most simply tell me what they remember. Later, I record events in the proper order, remove the unnecessary pieces, clarify, simplify, that sort of thing." Kvothe frowned. "I don't think that will do." Chronicler gave him a shy smile. "Storytellers are always different. They prefer their stories to be left alone, but they also prefer an attentive audience. I usually listen and record later. I have a nearly perfect memory." "Nearly perfect doesn't quite suit me." Kvothe pressed a finger against his lips. "How fast can you write?" Chronicler gave a knowing smile. "Faster than a man can talk." Kvothe raised an eyebrow. "I'd like to see that." Chronicler opened his satchel. He brought out a stack of fine, white paper and a bottle of ink. After arranging them carefully, he dipped a pen and looked expectantly at Kvothe. Kvothe sat forward in his chair and spoke quickly. "I am, we are, she is, he was, they will be." Chronicler's pen danced and scratched down the page as Kvothe watched it. "I, Chronicler, do hereby avow that I can neither read nor write, supine, irreverent, jackdaw, quartz, liqueur, egolient. Lin tach lusoren here. There was a young widow from Phaeton whose morals were hard as a rock. She went to confession for her true obsession." Kvothe leaned farther forward to watch as Chronicler wrote. "Interesting. Oh, you may stop." Chronicler smiled again and wiped his pen on a piece of cloth. The page in front of him held a single line of incomprehensible symbols. "Some sort of cipher?" Kvothe wondered aloud. "Very neatly done, too. I'll bet you don't spoil many pages." He turned the sheet to look at the writing more carefully. "I never spoil pages," Chronicler said haughtily. Kvothe nodded without looking up. "What does egolient mean?" Chronicler asked. "Oh, nothing. I made it up. I wanted to see if an unfamiliar word would slow you down." He stretched and pulled his chair closer to Chronicler's. "As soon as you show me how to read this, we can begin." Chronicler looked doubtful. "It's a very complex..." Seeing Kvothe's frown, he sighed. "I'll try." Chronicler drew a deep breath and began to write a line of symbols as he spoke. "There are around 50 different sounds we use to speak. I've given each of them a symbol consisting of one or two pen strokes. It's all sound. I could conceivably transcribe a language I don't even understand." He pointed. "These are different vowel sounds." "All vertical lines," Kvothe said, looking intently at the page. Chronicler paused, thrown off his stride. "Well, yes." "The consonants would be horizontal, then? And they would combine like this?" Taking the pen, Kvothe made a few marks of his own on the page. "Clever. You'd never need more than two or three for a word." Chronicler watched Kvothe quietly. Kvothe didn't notice. His attention was on the paper. "If this is am, then these must be the ah sounds." He motioned to a group of characters Chronicler had penned. Ah, a, ow. That would make these the o's. Kvothe nodded to himself and pressed the pen back into Chronicler's hand. "Show me the consonants." Chronicler penned them down numbly, reciting the sounds as he wrote. After a moment, Kvothe took the pen and completed the list himself, asking the dumbfounded Chronicler to correct him if he made a mistake. Chronicler watched and listened as Kvothe completed the list. From beginning to end, the whole process took about 15 minutes. He made no mistakes. "Wonderfully efficient system," Kvothe said appreciatively. "Very logical. Did you design it yourself?" Chronicler took a long moment before he spoke, staring at the rows of characters on the page in front of Kvothe. Finally, disregarding Kvothe's question, Chronicler asked, "Did you really learn Tima in a day?" Kvothe gave a faint smile and looked down at the table. "That's an old story. I'd almost forgotten. It took a day and a half, actually. A day and a half with no sleep. Why do you ask?" "I heard about it at the university. I never really believed it." He looked down at the page of his cipher in Kvothe's neat handwriting. "All of it?" Kvothe looked puzzled. "What?" "Did you learn the whole language?" "No, of course not," Kvothe said rather testily. "Only a portion of it. A large portion, to be sure, but I don't believe you can ever learn all of anything, let alone a language." Kvothe rubbed his hands together. "Now, are you ready?" Chronicler shook his head as if to clear it, set out a new sheet of paper, and nodded. Kvothe held up a hand to keep Chronicler from writing, and spoke. "I've never told this story before, and I doubt I'll ever tell it again." Kvothe leaned forward in his chair. "Before we begin, you must remember that I am of the Edema Ru. We were telling stories before Kalaptena burned, before there were books to write in, before there was music to play. When the first fire kindled, we Ru were there spinning stories in the circle of its flickering light." Kvothe nodded to the scribe. "I know your reputation as a great collector of stories and recorder of events." Kvothe's eyes became hard as flint, sharp as broken glass. "That said, do not presume to change a word of what I say. If I seem to wander, if I seem to stray, remember that true stories seldom take the straightest way." Chronicler nodded solemnly, trying to imagine the mind that could break apart his cipher in a piece of an hour, a mind that could learn a language in a day. Kvothe gave a gentle smile and looked around the room as if fixing it in his memory. Chronicler dipped his pen, and Kvothe looked down at his folded hands for as long as it takes to draw 3 deep breaths. Then he began to speak. "In some ways it began when I heard her singing, her voice twinning, mixing with my own. Her voice was like a portrait of her soul, wild as a fire, sharp as shattered glass, sweet and clean as clover." Kvothe shook his head. "No. It began at the university. I went to learn magic of the sort they talk about in stories. Magic like Taberlin the Great. I wanted to learn the name of the wind. I wanted fire and lightning. I wanted answers to 10,000 questions and access to their archives. But what I found at the university was much different than a story, and I was much dismayed. But I expect the true beginning lies in what led me to the university. Unexpected fires at twilight. A man with eyes like ice at the bottom of a well. The smell of blood and burning hair. The Chandrian." He nodded to himself. "Yes, I suppose that is where it all begins. This is, in many ways, a story about the Chandrian." Kvothe shook his head, as if to free himself from some dark thought. "But I suppose I must go even further back than that. If this is to be something resembling my book of deeds, I can spare the time. It will be worth it if I am remembered. If not flatteringly, then at least with some small account of accuracy. But what would my father say if he heard me telling a story this way? Begin at the beginning! Very well. If we are to have a telling, let's make it a proper one. Quoth sat forward in his chair. In the beginning, as far as I know, the world was spun out of the nameless void by Aleph, who gave everything a name. Or, depending on the version of the tale, found the names all things already possessed. Chronicler let slip a small laugh, though he did not look up from his page or pause in his writing. Quoth continued, smiling himself. I see you laugh. Very well. For simplicity's sake, let us assume I am the center of creation. In doing this, let us pass over innumerable boring stories. The rise and fall of empires, sagas of heroism, ballads of tragic love. Let us hurry forward to the only tale of any real importance. His smile broadened. Mine. My name is Quoth, pronounced nearly the same as Quoth. Names are important as they tell you a great deal about a person. I've had more names than anyone has a right to. The Adam call me Maedra, which, depending on how it's spoken, can mean the flame, the thunder, or the broken tree. The flame is obvious if you've ever seen me. I have red hair, bright. If I had been born a couple hundred years ago, I would probably have been burned as a demon. I keep it short, but it's unruly. When left to its own devices, it sticks up and makes me look as if I have been set afire. The thunder I attribute to a strong baritone and a great deal of stage training at an early age. I've never thought of the broken tree as very significant, although in retrospect I suppose it could be considered at least partially prophetic. My first mentor called me Elir, because I was clever, and I knew it. My first real lover called me Dulator, because she liked the sound of it. I have been called Shadikar, Lightfinger, and Sixstring. I have been called Quoth the Bloodless, Quoth the Arcane, and Quoth Kingkiller. I have earned those names, bought and paid for them. But I was brought up as Quoth. My father once told me it meant to know. I have, of course, been called many other things, most of them uncouth, although very few were unearned. I have stolen princesses back from sleeping barrow kings. I've burned down the town of Traban. I have spent the night with Felurian and left with both my sanity and my life. I was expelled from the university at a younger age than most people are allowed in. I tread paths by moonlight that others fear to speak of during day. I have talked to gods, loved women, and written songs that make the minstrels weep. You may have heard of me. Chapter 8. Thieves, Heretics, and Whores. If this story is to be something resembling my book of deeds, we must begin at the beginning. At the heart of who I truly am. To do this, you must remember that before I was anything else, I was one of the Edima Ru. Contrary to popular belief, not all traveling performers are of the Ru. My troupe was not some poor batch of mummers, japing at crossroads for pennies, singing for our suppers. We were court performers, Lord Greyfallow's men. Our arrival in most towns was more of an event than the midwinter pageantry and solenade games rolled together. There were usually at least 8 wagons in our troupe and well over 2 dozen performers, actors and acrobats, musicians and hand magicians, jugglers and jesters, my family. My father was a better actor and musician than any you have ever seen. My mother had a natural gift for words. They were both beautiful, with dark hair and easy laughter. They were Ru down to their bones, and that, really, is all that needs to be said. Save perhaps that my mother was a noble before she was a trooper. She told me that my father had lured her away from a miserable, dreary hell with sweet music and sweeter words. I could only assume she meant 3 crossings, where we went to visit relatives when I was very young. Once. My parents were never really married, by which I mean they never bothered making their relationship official with any church. I'm not embarrassed by the fact. They considered themselves married and didn't see much point in announcing it to any government or God. I respect that. In truth, they seemed more content and faithful than many officially married couples I have seen since. Our patron was Baron Greyfallow, and his name opened many doors that would ordinarily be closed to the Edema Rue. In return, we wore his colors, green and gray, and added to his reputation wherever we went. Once a year we spent 2 span at his manor, entertaining him and his household. It was a happy childhood, growing up in the center of an endless fair. My father would read to me from the great monologues during the long wagon rides between towns. Reciting mostly from memory, his voice would roll down the road for a quarter mile. I remember reading along, coming in on the secondary parts. My father would encourage me to try particularly good sections myself, and I learned to love the feel of good words. My mother and I would make up songs together. Other times, my parents would act out romantic dialogues while I followed along in the books. They seemed like games at the time. Little did I know how cunningly I was being taught. I was a curious child, quick with questions and eager to learn. With acrobats and actors as my teachers, it is little wonder that I never grew to dread lessons as most children do. The roads were safer in those days, but cautious folk would still travel with our troop for safety's sake. They supplemented my education. I learned an eclectic smattering of Commonwealth law from a traveling barrister too drunk or too pompous to realize he was lecturing an 8-year-old. I learned woodcraft from a huntsman named Lackleth, who traveled with us for nearly a whole season. I learned the sordid inner workings of the royal court in Modeg from a courtesan. As my father used to say, "Call a jack, call a spade, but always call a whore a lady. Their lives are hard enough, and it never hurts to be polite." Hetera smelled vaguely of cinnamon, and at 9 years old I found her fascinating without exactly knowing why. She taught me I should never do anything in private that I didn't want talked about in public, and cautioned me not to talk in my sleep. And then there was Abinthy, my first real teacher. He taught me more than all the others set end to end. If not for him, I would never have become the man I am today. I ask that you not hold it against him. He meant well.
"You'll have to move along," the mayor said. "Camp outside town, and no one will bother you so long as you don't start any fights or wander off with anything that isn't yours."
He gave my father a significant look.
"Then be on your merry way tomorrow. No performances. They're more trouble than they're worth."
"We are licensed," my father said, pulling out a folded piece of parchment from the inner pocket of his jacket.
"Charged to perform, in fact."
The mayor shook his head and made no motion to look at our writ of patronage.
"It makes folks rowdy," he said firmly. "Last time there was an unholy row during the play. Too much drinking, too much excitement. Folks tore the doors off the public house and smashed up the tables. The hall belongs to the town, you see. The town bears the expense of the repairs."
By this time our wagons were drawing attention. Trip was doing some juggling. Marion and his wife were putting on an impromptu string puppet show. I was watching my father from the back of our wagon.
"We certainly would not want to offend you or your patron," the mayor said. "However, the town can ill afford another evening such as that. As a gesture of goodwill, I'm willing to offer you a copper each, say 20 pennies, simply to be on your way and not make any trouble for us here."
Now, you have to understand that 20 pennies might be a good bit of money for some little ragamuffin troupe living hand to mouth, but for us it was simply insulting. He should have offered us 40 to play for the evening, free use of the public hall, a good meal, and beds at the inn. The last we would graciously decline, as their beds were no doubt lousy and those in our wagons were not. If my father was surprised or insulted, he did not show it.
"Pack up!"
he shouted over one shoulder. Trip tucked his juggling stones into various pockets without so much as a flourish. There was a disappointed chorus from several dozen townsfolk as the puppets stopped mid-jape and were packed away. The mayor looked relieved, brought out his purse, and pulled out 2 silver pennies.
"I'll be sure to tell the Baron of your generosity," my father said carefully as the mayor laid the pennies into his hand.
The mayor froze mid-motion.
"Baron?"
"Baron Greyfallow." My father paused, looking for some spark of recognition on the mayor's face.
"Lord of the Eastern Marshes, Hudumbran by Theron and the wide Cont Hills."
My father looked around at the horizon.
"We are still in the wide Cont Hills, aren't we?"
"Well, yes," the mayor said.
"But Squire Semlin..."
"Oh, we're in Semlin's fife," my father exclaimed, looking around as if now just getting his bearings.
"Thin gentleman, tidy little beard."
He brushed his chin with his fingers. The mayor nodded numbly.
"Charming fellow, lovely singing voice. Met him when we were entertaining the Baron last midwinter." "Of course,"
the mayor paused significantly.
"Might I see your writ?"
I watched as the mayor read it. It took him a little while, as my father had not bothered to mention the majority of the Baron's titles, such as the Viscount of Montrone and Lord of Trelliston. The upshot was this. It was true that Squire Semlin controlled this little town and all the land around it, but Semlin owed fealty directly to Greyfallow. In more concrete terms, Greyfallow was captain of the ship. Semlin scrubbed the planking and saluted him. The mayor refolded the parchment and handed it back to my father.
"I see."
That was all. I remember being stunned when the mayor didn't apologize or offer my father more money. My father paused as well, then continued.
"The city is your jurisdiction, sir, but we'll perform either way. It will either be here or just outside the city limits." "You can't use the public house," the mayor said firmly. "I won't have it wrecked again."
"We can play right here," my father pointed to the market square. "It will be enough space, and it keeps everyone right here in town." The mayor hesitated, though I could hardly believe it. We sometimes chose to play on the green because the local buildings weren't big enough. 2 of our wagons were built to become stages for just that eventuality. But in my whole 11 years of memory, I could barely count on both hands the times we'd been forced to play the green. We had never played outside the city limits. But we were spared that. The mayor nodded at last and gestured my father closer. I slipped out the back of the wagon and moved close enough to catch the end of what he said.
"God-fearing folk around here. Nothing vulgar or heretical. We had a double handful of trouble with the last troop that came through here. 2 fights, folks missing their laundry, and 1 of Branston's daughters got herself in a family way."
I was outraged. I waited for my father to show the mayor the sharp side of his tongue, to explain the difference between mere traveling performers and Edema Rue. We didn't steal. We would never let things get so out of control that a bunch of drunks ruined the hall where we were playing. But my father did nothing of the sort. He just nodded and walked back toward our wagon. He gestured and Trip started juggling again. The puppets reemerged from their cases. As he came around the wagon, he saw me standing, half hidden, beside the horses.
"I'm guessing you heard the whole thing from the look on your face," he said with a wry grin. "Let it go, my boy. He gets full marks for honesty, if not for grace. He just says out loud what other folk keep in the quiet of their hearts. Why do you think I have everyone stay in pairs when we go about our business in bigger towns?"
I knew it for the truth. Still, it was a hard pill for a young boy to swallow.
20 pennies, I said scathingly. "As if he were offering us charity."
That was the hardest part of growing up Edema Rue. We are strangers everywhere. Many folk view us as vagabonds and beggars, while others deem us little more than thieves, heretics, and whores. It's hard to be wrongfully accused, but it's worse when the people looking down on you are clods who have never read a book or traveled more than 20 miles from the place they were born. My father laughed and ruffed my hair.
Just pity him, my boy. Tomorrow we'll be on our way, but he'll have to keep his own disagreeable company until the day he dies.
He's an ignorant blatherskate, I said bitterly. He lay a firm hand on my shoulder, letting me know I'd said enough.
This is what comes of getting too close to Etur, I suppose. Tomorrow we'll head south. Greener pastures, kinder folk, prettier women.
He cupped an ear toward the wagon and nudged me with his elbow.
I can hear everything you say,
my mother called sweetly from inside. My father grinned and winked at me.
So what play are we going to do? I asked my father. Nothing vulgar, mind you. They're God-fearing folk in these parts.
He looked at me.
What would you pick?
I gave it a long moment's thought.
I'd play something from the Brightfield cycle. The Forging of the Path or some such.
My father made a face.
Not a very good play.
I shrugged. They won't know the difference. Besides, it's chock full of Telu, so no one will complain about it being vulgar. I looked up at the sky. I just hope it doesn't rain on us halfway through.
My father looked up at the clouds.
It will. Still, there are worse things than playing in the rain.
Like playing in the rain and getting shimmed on the deal? I asked.
The mayor hurried up to us, moving at a fast walk. There was a thin sheen of sweat on his forehead, and he was puffing a little bit, as if he'd been running.
I talked it over with a few members of the council, and we decided that it would be quite all right for you to use the public house if you would care to.
My father's body language was perfect. It was perfectly clear he was offended, but far too polite to say anything.
I certainly wouldn't want to put you out.
No, no. No bother at all. I insist, in fact.
Very well, if you insist.
The mayor smiled and hurried away.
Well, that's a little better.
My father sighed.
No need to tighten our belts yet.
Halfpenny a head, that's right. Anyone without a head gets in free, thank you, sir.
Trip was working the door, making sure everyone paid to see the play.
Halfpenny a head, though, by the rosy glow in your lady's cheeks, I should be charging you for a head and a half, not that it's any of my business, mind you.
Trip had the quickest tongue of anyone in the troupe, which made him the best man for the job of making sure no one tried to fast-talk or bully their way inside. Wearing his green and gray jester's motley, Trip could say just about anything and get away with it.
Hello, Mum, no charge for the little one, but if he starts to squawk, you'd best give him the tit quick or take him outside.
Trip carried on his unending patter.
That's right, Halfpenny. Yes, sir, empty head still pays full price.
Though it was always fun to watch Trip work, most of my attention was on a wagon that had rolled into the other end of town about a quarter hour ago. The mayor had argued with the old man driving it, then stormed off. Now, I saw the mayor heading back to the wagon, accompanied by a tall fellow carrying a long cudgel, the constable, unless I missed my guess. My curiosity got the best of me, and I made my way toward the wagon, doing my best to stay out of sight. The mayor and the old man were arguing again by the time I got close enough to hear. The constable stood nearby, looking irritated and anxious.
Told you, I don't have a license. I don't need a license. Does a peddler need a license? Does a tinker need a license?
You're not a tinker,
the mayor said.
Don't try to pass yourself off as one.
I'm not trying to pass myself off as anything,
the old man snapped. I'm a tinker and a peddler, and I'm more than both. I'm an arcanist, you great dithering heap of idiot.
My point exactly,
the mayor said doggedly.
We're God-fearing people in these parts. We don't want any meddling with dark things, better left alone. We don't want the trouble your kind can bring.
My kind, the old man said.
What do you know about my kind? There probably hasn't been an Arcanist through these parts in 50 years.
We like it that way. Just turn around and go back the way you came.
Like hell if I'm spending a night in the rain because of your thick head, the man said hotly. I don't need your permission to rent a room or to do business in the street. Now get away from me, or I'll show you firsthand what sort of trouble my kind can be.
Fear flashed across the mayor's face before it was overwhelmed by outrage. He gestured over one shoulder at the constable.
Then you'll spend the night in jail for vagrancy and threatening behavior. We'll let you on your way in the morning if you've learned to keep a civil tongue in your head.
The constable advanced on the wagon, his cudgel held cautiously at his side. The old man stood his ground and raised one hand. A deep red light welled up from the front corners of his wagon.
That's far enough, he said ominously. Things could get ugly otherwise.
After a moment's surprise, I realized the strange light came from a pair of sympathy lamps the old man had mounted on his wagon. I had seen one before in Lord Greyfellow's library. They were brighter than gaslight, steadier than candles or lamps, and lasted nearly forever. They were also terribly expensive. I was willing to bet that no one in this little town had ever heard of them, let alone seen one. The constable stopped in his tracks when the light began to swell, but when nothing else seemed to happen, he set his jaw and kept walking toward the wagon. The old man's expression grew anxious.
"Now hold on a moment,"
he said as the red light from the wagon started to fade.
"We don't want..." "Shut your clapper, you old shitfire!"
the constable said. He snatched at the Arcanist's arm as if he were sticking his hand into an oven. Then, when nothing happened, he smiled and grew more confident.
"Don't think I won't knock you a good one to keep you from working any more of your devilry!" "Well done, Tom," the mayor said, radiating relief. "Bring him along, and we'll send someone back for the wagon."
The constable grinned and twisted the old man's arm. The Arcanist bent at the waist and gasped a short, painful breath. From where I hid, I saw the Arcanist's face change from anxious to pained to angry all in a second. I saw his mouth move. A furious gust of wind came out of nowhere, as if a storm had suddenly burst with no warning. The wind struck the old man's wagon, and it tipped onto two wheels before slamming back down onto four. The constable staggered and fell as if he'd been struck by the hand of God. Even where I hid, nearly 30 feet away, the wind was so strong that I was forced to take a step forward, as if I'd been pushed roughly from behind.
"Begone!" the old man shouted angrily. "Trouble me no longer! I will set fire to your blood and fill you with a fear like ice and iron!"
There was something familiar about his words, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Both the mayor and the constable turned tail and ran, their eyes white and wild as startled horses. The wind faded as quickly as it had come. The whole sudden burst couldn't have lasted more than 5 seconds. As most of the townsfolk were gathered around the public house, I doubted anyone had seen it except for me, the mayor, the constable, and the old man's donkeys who stood placidly in their harness, utterly unperturbed.
"Leave this place clean of your foul presence," the Arcanist muttered to himself as he watched them go. "By the power of my name, I command it to be so."
I finally realized why his words seemed so familiar. He was quoting lines from the exorcism scene of Deonica. Not many folk knew that play. The old man turned back to his wagon and began to extemporize.
"I'll turn you into butter on a summer day. I'll turn you into a poet with the soul of a priest. I'll fill you with lemon custard and push you out a window," he spat. "Bastards!"
His irritation seemed to leave him, and he heaved a great, weary sigh.
"Well, that couldn't have gone much worse,"
the old man muttered as he rubbed at the shoulder of the arm the constable had twisted.
"Do you think they'll come back with a mob behind them?"
For a second, I thought the old man was talking to me. Then I realized the truth. He was talking to his donkeys.
"I don't think so either," he said to them.
but I've been wrong before. Let's stay near the edge of town and have a look at the last of the oats, shall we?" He clambered up into the back of the wagon and came down with a wide bucket and a nearly empty burlap sack. He upended the sack into the bucket and seemed disheartened by the results. He took out a handful for himself before nudging the bucket toward the donkeys with his foot. "Don't give me that look," he said to them. "It's short rations all around. Besides, you can graze." He petted one donkey while he ate his handful of rough oats, stopping occasionally to spit out a husk. It struck me as very sad. His old man all alone on the road with no one to talk to but his donkeys. It's hard for us, Edema Rue, but at least we had each other. This man had no one.
"We've wandered too far from civilization, boys. The folk that need me don't trust me, and the ones that trust me can't afford me."
The old man peered into his purse.
"We've got a penny and a half, so our options are limited. Do we want to be wet tonight or hungry tomorrow? We're not going to do any business, so it will probably be one or the other."
I slunk around the edge of the building until I could see what was written on the side of the old man's wagon. It read, "Abinthy, Arcanist Extraordinary, Scribe, Dowser, Chemist, Dentist, Rare Goods, All Ailments Tended, Lost Items Found, Anything Mended, No Horoscopes, No Love Potions, No Malefaction." Abinthy noticed me as soon as I stepped out from behind the building where I'd been hiding.
"Hello there. Can I help you?"
"You've misspelled ailments," I pointed out. He looked surprised.
"It's a joke, actually," he explained. "I brew a bit."
"Oh, ale," I said, nodding. "I get it." I brought my hand out of my pocket. "Can you sell me anything for a penny?"
He seemed stuck between amusement and curiosity.
"What are you looking for?"
"I'd like some Lucilium." We had performed Fairy and the Fair a dozen times in the last month, and it had filled my young mind with intrigue and assassination.
"Are you expecting someone to poison you?" he said, somewhat taken aback.
"Not really, but it seems to me that if you wait around until you know you need an antidote, it's probably too late to pick one up."
"I suppose I could sell you a penny's worth," he said. "That would be about a dose for a person your size. But it's dangerous stuff in its own right. It only cures certain poisons. You can hurt yourself if you take it at the wrong time."
"Oh," I said. "I didn't know that." In the play, it was touted as an infallible cure-all.
Abinthy tapped his lips thoughtfully.
"Can you answer me a question in the meantime?"
I nodded.
"Whose troop is that?"
"In a way, it's mine," I said. "But in another way, it's my father's, because he runs the show and points which way the wagons go. But it's Baron Greyfallow's, too, because he's our patron. We're Lord Greyfallow's men."
The old man gave me an amused look.
"I've heard of you. Good troop. Good reputation."
I nodded, not seeing any point in false modesty.
"Do you think your father might be interested in taking on any help?" he asked. "I don't claim to be much of an actor, but I'm handy to have around. I could make you face paint and rouge that aren't all full of lead and mercury and arsenic. I can do lights, too, quick, clean, and bright. Different colors if you want them."
I didn't have to think too hard about it. Candles were expensive and vulnerable to drafts. Torches were dirty and dangerous, and everyone in the troop learned the dangers of cosmetics at an early age. It was hard to become an old seasoned trooper when you painted poison on yourself every third day and ended up raving mad by the time you were 25. "I may be overstepping myself a little," I said as I held out my hand for him to shake, "but let me be the first to welcome you to the troop." If this is to be a full and honest account of my life and deeds, I feel I should mention that my reasons for inviting Ben into our troop were not entirely altruistic. It's true that quality cosmetics and clean lights were a welcome addition to our troop. It's also true that I'd felt sorry for the old man alone on the road. But underneath it all, I was moved by my curiosity. I had seen Abinthy do something I could not explain. Something strange and wonderful. Not his trick with the sympathy lamps. I recognized that for what it was. Showmanship. A bluff to impress ignorant townsfolk. What he had done afterward was different. He called the wind, and the wind came. It was magic. Real magic. The sort of magic I'd heard about in stories of Tamerlan the Great. The sort of magic I hadn't believed in since I was 6. Now, I didn't know what to believe. So I invited him into our troop, hoping to find answers to my questions. Though I didn't know it at the time, I was looking for the name of the wind. Chapter 9. Riding the Wagon with Ben. Abinthy was the first arcanist I ever met. A strange, exciting figure to a young boy. He was knowledgeable in all the sciences. Botany, astronomy, psychology, anatomy, alchemy, geology, chemistry. He was portly, with twinkling eyes that moved quickly from one thing to another. He had a strip of dark gray hair running around the back of his head, but, and this is what I remember most about him, no eyebrows. Rather, he had them, but they were in a perpetual state of regrowing from being burned off in the course of his alchemical pursuits. It made him look surprised and quizzical all at once. He spoke gently, laughed often, and never exercised his wit at the expense of others. He cursed like a drunken sailor with a broken leg, but only at his donkeys. They were called Alpha and Beta, and Abinthy fed them carrots and lumps of sugar when he thought no one was looking. Chemistry was his particular love, and my father said he'd never known a man to run a better still. By his second day in our troop, I was making a habit of riding in his wagon. I would ask him questions, and he would answer. Then he would ask for songs, and I would pluck them out for him on a lute I borrowed from my father's wagon. He would even sing from time to time. He had a bright, reckless tenor that was always wandering off, looking for notes in the wrong places. More often than not, he stopped and laughed at himself when it happened. He was a good man, and there was no conceit in him. Not long after he joined our troop, I asked Abinthy what it was like being an arcanist. He gave me a thoughtful look. "Have you ever known an arcanist?" "We paid one to mend a cracked axle on the road once." I paused to think. "He was heading inland with a caravan of fish." Abinthy made a dismissive gesture.
"No, no, boy. I'm talking about arcanists, not some poor chill charmer who works his way back and forth across caravan routes, trying to keep fresh meat from rotting."
"What's the difference?" I asked, sensing it was expected of me.
"Well," he said, "that might take a bit of explaining."
"I've got nothing but time." Abinthy gave me an appraising look. I'd been waiting for it. It was the look that said, "You don't sound as young as you look." I'd hoped he'd come to grips with it fairly soon. It gets tiresome being spoken to as if you are a child, even if you happen to be one. He took a deep breath.
"Just because someone knows a trick or two doesn't mean they're an arcanist. They might know how to set a bone or read Eld Vintic. Maybe they even know a little sympathy, but..."
"Sympathy?" I interrupted as politely as possible.
"You'd probably call it magic,"
Abinthy said reluctantly.
"It's not, really." He shrugged. "But even knowing sympathy doesn't make you an arcanist. A true arcanist has worked his way through the arcanum at the university."
At his mention of the arcanum, I bristled with 24 new questions. Not so many, you might think, but when you added them to the 100 questions I carried with me wherever I went, I was stretched nearly to bursting. Only through a severe effort of will did I remain silent, waiting for Abinthy to continue on his own. Abinthy, however, noticed my reaction.
"So, you've heard about the Arcanum, have you?"
He seemed amused. Tell me what you've heard, then. This small prompt was all the excuse I needed.
I heard from a boy in Temper Glen that if your arm's cut off, they can sew it back on at the university. Can they really? Some stories say Taberlin the Great went there to learn the names of all things. There's a library with 1,000 books. Are there really that many?
He answered the last question, the others having rushed by too quickly for him to respond.
More than 1,000, actually. 10 times 10,000 books. More than that. More books than you could ever read.
Abinthy's voice grew vaguely wistful.
More books than I could read? Somehow I doubted that.
Ben continued.
The people you see riding with caravans, charmers who keep food from spoiling, dowsers, fortune-tellers, toad-eaters, aren't real arcanists any more than all traveling performers are a Demaru. They might know a little alchemy, a little sympathy, a little medicine.
He shook his head.
But they're not arcanists. A lot of people pretend to be. They wear robes and put on airs to take advantage of the ignorant and gullible. But here's how you tell a true arcanist.
Abinthy pulled a fine chain over his head and handed it to me. It was the first time I had ever seen an Arcanum Guilder. It looked rather unimpressive, just a flat piece of lead with some unfamiliar writing stamped onto it.
That is a true Giltha, or Guilder, if you prefer, Abinthy explained with some satisfaction. It's the only sure way to be certain of who is and who isn't an Arcanist. Your father asked to see mine before he let me ride with your troop. It shows he's a man of the world.
He watched me with a sly disinterest.
Uncomfortable, isn't it?
I gritted my teeth and nodded. My hand had gone numb as soon as I'd touched it. I was curious to study the markings on its front and back, but after the space of 2 breaths, my arm was numb to the shoulder, as if I had slept on it all night. I wondered if my whole body would go numb if I held it long enough. I was prevented from finding out, as the wagon hit a bump and my numbed hand almost let Abinthy's Guilder fall to the footboard of the wagon. He snatched it up and slipped it back over his head, chuckling.
"How can you stand it?"
I asked, trying to rub a little feeling back into my hand.
"It only feels that way to other people," he explained. "To its owner, it's just warm." That's how you can tell the difference between an arcanist and someone who has a knack for finding water or guessing at the weather.
Trip has something like that, I said. He rolls 7s.
That's a little different, Abinthy laughed. Not anything so unexplainable as a knack.
He slouched a little farther down into his seat.
Probably for the best. A 200 years ago, a person was good as dead if folks saw he had a knack. The Talons called them demon signs, and burned folk if they had them.
Abinthy's mood seemed to have taken a downward turn.
We had to break Trip out of jail once or twice,
I said, trying to lighten the tone of the conversation. But no one actually tried to burn him. Abinthy gave a tired smile.
I suspect Trip has a pair of clever dice or an equally clever skill, which probably extends to cards as well. I thank you for your timely warning, but a knack is something else entirely.
I can't abide being patronized.
Trip can't cheat to save his life,
I said a little more sharply than I had intended.
And anyone in the troop can tell good dice from bad. Trip throws 7s. It doesn't matter whose dice he uses, he rolls 7s. If he bets on someone, they roll 7s. If he so much as bumps a table with loose dice on it, 7.
Abinthy
nodded to himself.
My apologies. That does sound like a knack. I'd be curious to see it.
I nodded. Take your own dice. We haven't let him play for years. A thought occurred to me. It might not still work. He shrugged.
Knacks don't go away so easily as that. When I was growing up in Staup, I knew a young man with a knack. Uncommonly good with plants.
Abinthy's grin was gone as he looked off at something I couldn't see.
His tomatoes would be red while everyone else's vines were still climbing. His squash were bigger and sweeter, His grapes didn't hardly have to be bottled before they started being wine.
He trailed off, his eyes far away. Did they burn him?
I asked, with the morbid curiosity of the young.
What? No, of course not. I'm not that old.
He scowled at me in mock severity.
There was a drought and he got run out of town. His poor mother was heartbroken.
There was a moment of silence. Two wagons ahead of us, I heard Taryn and Shandy rehearsing lines from The Swine Herd and The Nightingale. Abinthy seemed to be listening as well in an offhand way. After Taryn got himself lost halfway through Fane's Garden monologue, I turned back to face him.
"Do they teach acting at the university?" I asked.
Abinthy shook his head, slightly amused by the question.
"Many things, but not that."
I looked over at Abinthy and saw him watching me. His eyes danced.
"Could you teach me some of those other things?" I asked.
He smiled, and it was as easy as that. Abinthy proceeded to give me a brief overview of each of the sciences. While his main love was for chemistry, he believed in a rounded education. I learned how to work the sextant, the compass, the slipstick, the abacus. More important, I learned to do without. Within a span, I could identify any chemical in his cart. In 2 months, I could distill liquor until it was too strong to drink, bandage a wound, set a bone, and diagnose hundreds of sicknesses from symptoms. I knew the process for making 4 different aphrodisiacs, 3 concoctions for contraception, 9 for impotence, and 2 filters referred to simply as Maiden's Helper. Abinthy was rather vague about the purpose of the last of these, but I had some strong suspicions. I learned the formulae for 12 poisons and acids, and 100 medicines and cure-alls, some of which even worked. I doubled my herb lore in theory, if not in practice. Abinthy started to call me Red, and I called him Ben, first in retaliation, then in friendship. Only now, far after the fact, do I recognize how carefully Ben prepared me for what was to come at the university. He did it subtly, once or twice a day, mixed in with my normal lectures. Ben would present me with a little mental exercise I would have to master before we went on to anything else. He made me play Tarani without a board, keeping track of the stones in my head. Other times, he would stop in the middle of a conversation and make me repeat everything said in the last few minutes, word for word. This was levels beyond the simple memorization I had practiced for the stage. My mind was learning to work in different ways, becoming stronger. It felt the same way your body feels after a day of splitting wood, or swimming, or sex. You feel exhausted, languorous, and almost godlike. This feeling was similar, except it was my intellect that was weary and expanded, languid and latently powerful. I could feel my mind starting to awaken. I seemed to gain momentum as I progressed, like when water starts to wash away a dam made of sand. I don't know if you understand what a geometric progression is, but that is the best way to describe it. Through it all, Ben continued to teach me mental exercises that I was half convinced he constructed out of sheer meanness. Chapter 10. Ailer and Several Stones. Ben held up a chunk of dirty fieldstone slightly bigger than his fist.
"What will happen if I let go of this rock?"
I thought for a bit. Simple questions during lesson time were very seldom simple. Finally, I gave the obvious answer. "It will probably fall." He raised an eyebrow. I had kept him busy over the last several months, and he hadn't had the leisure to accidentally burn them off.
"Probably? You sound like a sophist, boy. Hasn't it always fallen before?"
I stuck my tongue out at him.
"Don't try to boldface your way through this one. That's a fallacy. You taught me that yourself."
He grinned.
"Fine. Would it be fair to say you believe it will fall?"
"Fair enough.
I want you to believe it will fall up when I let go of it."
His grin widened. I tried.
It was like doing mental gymnastics. After a while, I nodded.
Okay.
How well do you believe it?
Not very well, I admitted.
I want you to believe this rock will float away. Believe it with a faith that will move mountains and shake trees.
He paused and seemed to take a different tack.
Do you believe in God? Telu?
After a fashion.
Not good enough.
Do you believe in your parents? I gave a little smile.
Sometimes. I can't see them right now.
He snorted and unhooked the slapstick he used to goad Alpha and Beta when they were being lazy.
Do you believe in this, Alir?
He only called me Alir when he thought I was being especially willfully obstinate. He held out the stick for my inspection. There was a malicious glitter in his eye. I decided not to tempt fate. Yes.
Good.
He slapped the side of the wagon with it, producing a sharp crack. One of Alpha's ears pivoted around at the noise, uncertain as to whether or not it was directed at her.
That's the sort of belief I want. It's called Ailer, riding crop belief. When I drop this stone, it will float away, free as a bird.
He brandished the slapstick a bit.
And none of your petty philosophy, or I'll make you sorry you ever took a shining to that little game.
I nodded. I cleared my mind with one of the tricks I'd already learned and bore down on believing. I started to sweat. After what may have been 10 minutes, I nodded again. He let go of the rock. It fell. I began to get a headache. He picked the rock back up.
Do you believe that it floated?
No. I sulked, rubbing my temples.
Good. It didn't. Never fool yourself into perceiving things that don't exist. It's a fine line to walk, but sympathy is not an art for the weak-willed.
He held out the rock again.
Do you believe it will float?
It didn't.
It doesn't matter. Try again.
He shook the stone.
Ailer is the cornerstone of sympathy. If you are going to impose your will on the world, you must have control over what you believe.
I tried and I tried. It was the most difficult thing I had ever done. It took me almost all afternoon. Finally, Ben was able to drop the rock, and I retained my firm belief that it wouldn't fall, despite evidence to the contrary. I heard the thump of the rock, and I looked at Ben. "I've got it," I said calmly, feeling more than a little smug. He looked at me out of the corner of his eye, as if he didn't quite believe me, but didn't want to admit it. He picked at the rock absently with one fingernail, then shrugged and held it up again.
I want you to believe the rock will fall, and that the rock will not fall when I let go of it.
He grinned. I went to bed late that night. I had a nosebleed and a smile of satisfaction. I held the two separate beliefs loosely in my mind and let their singing discord lull me into senselessness.
Being able to think about two disparate things at once, aside from being wonderfully efficient, was roughly akin to being able to sing harmony with yourself. It turned into a favorite game of mine. After 2 days of practicing, I was able to sing a trio. Soon, I was doing the mental equivalent of palming cards and juggling knives.
There were many other lessons, though none were quite so pivotal as the Ailer. Ben taught me Heart of Stone, a mental exercise that let you set aside your emotions and prejudices and let you think clearly about whatever you wished. Ben said a man who truly mastered Heart of Stone could go to his sister's funeral without ever shedding a tear. He also taught me a game called Seek the Stone. The point of the game was to have one part of your mind hide an imaginary stone in an imaginary room, and then you had another, separate part of your mind try to find it. Practically, it teaches valuable mental control. If you can really play Seek the Stone, then you are developing an iron-hard Ailer of the sort you need for sympathy. However, while being able to think about two things at the same time is terribly convenient, the training it takes to get there is frustrating at best, and at other times, rather disturbing. I remember one time I looked for the stone for almost an hour before I consented to ask the other half of me where I'd hidden it, only to find I hadn't hidden the stone at all. I had merely been waiting to see how long I would look before giving up. Have you ever been annoyed and amused with yourself at the same time? It's an interesting feeling, to say the very least. Another time, I asked for hints and ended up jeering at myself. It's no wonder that many arcanists you meet are a little eccentric, if not downright cracked. As Ben had said, sympathy is not for the weak of mind. Chapter 11. The Binding of Iron. I sat in the back of Abinthy's wagon. It was a wonderful place for me, home to 100 bottles and bundles, saturated with 1,000 smells. To my young mind, it was usually more fun than a tinker's cart, but not today. It had rained heavily the night before, and the road was a thick morass of mud. Since the troop was not on any particular schedule, we had decided to wait for a day or two to give the roads time to dry. It was a fairly common occurrence, and it happened to fall at the perfect time for Ben to further my education. So I sat at the wooden work table in the back of Ben's wagon and chafed at wasting the day listening to him lecture me about things I already understood. My thoughts must have been apparent, because Abinthy sighed and sat down beside me. "Not quite what you expected, eh?" I relaxed a bit, knowing his tone meant a temporary reprieve from the lecture. He gathered up a handful of the iron drabs that were sitting on the table and clinked them together thoughtfully in his hand. He looked at me. "Did you learn to juggle all at once? 5 balls at a time? Knives too?" I flushed a bit at the memory. Trip hadn't even let me try 3 balls at first. He'd made me juggle 2. I'd even dropped them a couple of times. I told Ben so. "Right," Ben said. "Master this trick, and you get to learn another." I expected him to stand up and start back into the lesson, but he didn't. Instead, he held out the handful of iron drabs. "What do you know about these?" He clattered them together in his hand. "In what respect?" I asked. "Physically, chemically, historically?" "Historically," he grinned. "Astound me with your grasp of historical minutiae, Elir." I had asked him what Elir meant once. He claimed it meant wise one, but I had my doubts from the way his mouth had quirked when he said it. "A long time ago, the people who..." "How long ago?" I frowned at him in mock severity. "Roughly 2,000 years ago, the nomadic folk who roamed the foothills around the Shalda Mountains were brought together under one chieftain." "What was his name?" "Heldred. His sons were Heldim and Heldar. Would you like his entire lineage, or should I just get to the point?" I glowered at him.
"Sorry, sir."
Ben sat up straight in his seat and assumed such an aspect of rapt attention that we both broke into grins. I started again. "Heldred eventually controlled the foothills around the Shalda. This meant that he controlled the mountains themselves. They started to plant crops, their nomadic lifestyle was abandoned, and they slowly began to..."
"Get to the point?"
Abinthy asked. He tossed the drabs onto the table in front of me. I ignored him as best I could. "They controlled the only plentiful and easily accessible source of metal for a great distance, and soon they were the most skilled workers of those metals as well. They exploited this advantage and gained a great deal of wealth and power. Until this point, barter was the most common method of trade. Some larger cities coined their own currency, but outside those cities, the money was only worth the weight of the metal. Bars of metal were better for bartering, but full bars of metal were inconvenient to carry." Ben gave me his best bored student face. The effect was only slightly inhibited by the fact that he had burned his eyebrows off again about 2 days ago.
"You're not going to go into the merits of representational currency, are you?"
I took a deep breath and resolved not to pester Ben so much when he was lecturing me. The no-longer nomads called the Sealdom by now were the first to establish a standardized currency. By cutting one of these smaller bars into 5 pieces, you get 5 drabs. I began to piece 2 rows of 5 drabs each together to illustrate my point. They resembled little ingots of metal. 10 drabs are the same as a copper jot. 10 jots...
Good enough, Ben broke in, startling me. So these 2 drabs...
He held a pair out for my inspection.
Could have come from the same bar, right?
Actually, they probably cast them individually. I trailed off under a glare.
Sure. So there's something still connecting them, right?
He gave me the look again.
I didn't really agree, but knew better than to interrupt.
Right.
He set them both on the table.
So, when you move one, the other should move, right?
I agreed for the sake of argument, then reached out to move one. But Ben stopped my hand, shaking his head.
You've got to remind them first. You've got to convince them, in fact.
He brought out a bowl and decanted a slow blob of pine pitch into it. He dipped 1 of the drabs into the pitch and stuck the other one to it, spoke several words I didn't recognize, and slowly pulled the bits apart, strands of pitch stretching between them. He set 1 on the table, keeping the other in his hand. Then he muttered something else and relaxed. He raised his hand, and the drab on the table mimicked the motion. He danced his hand around, and the brown piece of iron bobbed in the air. He looked from me to the coin.
The law of sympathy is one of the most basic parts of magic. It states that the more similar 2 objects are, the greater the sympathetic link. The greater the link, the more easily they influence each other.
Your definition is circular. He set down the coin. His lecturer's facade gave way to a grin as he tried with marginal success to wipe the pitch off his hands with a rag. He thought for a while.
Seems pretty useless, doesn't it?
I gave a hesitant nod. Trick questions were fairly common around lesson time.
Would you rather learn how to call the wind?
His eyes danced at me. He murmured a word and the canvas ceiling of the wagon rustled around us. I felt a grin capture my face, wolfish.
Too bad, Ilir.
His grin was wolfish too, and savage.
You need to learn your letters before you can write. You need to learn the fingerings on the strings before you can play and sing.
He pulled out a piece of paper and jotted a couple of words on it.
The trick is in holding the Ailer firm in your mind. You need to believe they are connected. You need to know they are.
He handed me the paper.
Here is the phonetic pronunciation. It's called the sympathetic binding of parallel motion. Practice.
He looked even more lupine than before, old and grizzled, with no eyebrows. He left to wash his hands. I cleared my mind using heart of stone. Soon I was floating on a sea of dispassionate calm. I stuck the 2 bits of metal together with pine pitch. I fixed in my mind the Ailer, the riding crop belief, that the 2 drabs were connected. I said the words, pulled the coins apart, spoke the last word, and waited. No rush of power. No flash of hot or cold. No radiant beam of light struck me. I was rather disappointed. At least as disappointed as I could be in the heart of stone. I lifted the coin in my hand, and the coin on the table lifted itself in a similar fashion. It was magic. There was no doubt about that. But I felt rather underwhelmed. I had been expecting... I don't know what I'd been expecting. It wasn't this. The rest of that day was spent experimenting with the simple sympathetic binding Abinthy had taught me. I learned that almost anything could be bound together. An iron drab and a silver talent. A stone and a piece of fruit. 2 bricks. A clod of earth and 1 of the donkeys. It took me about 2 hours to figure out that the pine pitch wasn't necessary. When I asked him, Ben admitted that it was merely an aid for concentration. I think he was surprised that I figured it out without being told.
Let me sum up sympathy very quickly, since you will probably never need to have anything other than a rough comprehension of how these things work. First, energy cannot be created or destroyed. When you are lifting one drab and the other rises off the table, the one in your hand feels as heavy as if you're lifting both, because in fact, you are. That's in theory. In practice, it feels like you're lifting three drabs. No sympathetic link is perfect. The more dissimilar the items, the more energy is lost. Think of it as a leaky aqueduct leading to a water wheel. A good sympathetic link has very few leaks, and most of the energy is used. A bad link is full of holes. Very little of the effort you put into it goes toward what you want it to do. For instance, I tried linking a piece of chalk to a glass bottle of water. There was very little similarity between the two, so even though the bottle of water might have weighed 2 pounds, when I tried to lift the chalk, it felt like 60 pounds. The best link I found was a tree branch I had broken in half. After I understood this little piece of sympathy, Ben taught me others. A dozen sympathetic bindings. 100 little tricks for channeling power. Each of them was a different word in a vast vocabulary I was just beginning to speak. Quite often, it was tedious, and I'm not telling you the half of it. Ben continued giving me a smattering of lessons in other areas. History, arithmetic, and chemistry. But I grabbed at whatever he could teach me about sympathy. He doled out his secrets sparingly, making me prove I'd mastered one before giving me another. But I seemed to have a knack for it above and beyond my natural penchant for absorbing knowledge, so there was never too long a wait. I don't mean to imply that the road was always smooth. The same curiosity that made me such an eager student also led me into trouble with fair regularity. One evening, as I was building up my parents' cook fire, my mother caught me chanting a rhyme I had heard the day before. Not knowing that she was behind me, she overheard as I knocked one stick of firewood against another and absent-mindedly recited, "Seven things has Lady Lackless, keeps them underneath her black dress, one a ring that's not for wearing, one a sharp word not for swearing, right beside her husband's candle, there's a door without a handle, in a box no lid or locks, Lackless keeps her husband's rocks. There's a secret she's been keeping, she's been dreaming and not sleeping, on a road that's not for traveling, Lackless likes her riddle raveling." I had heard a little girl chant it as she played hop-skip. I'd only heard it twice, but it had stuck in my head. It was memorable, as most child rhymes are. But my mother heard me and came over to stand by the fire. "What were you just saying, sweet?" Her tone wasn't angry, but I could tell she wasn't pleased either. "Something I heard back in Fallows," I said evasively. Running off with town children was a largely forbidden activity. Distrust turns quickly to dislike, my father told new members of our troop, so stay together when you're in town, and be polite. I laid some heavier sticks on the fire and let the flames lick them. My mother was silent for a while, and I was beginning to hope she would leave it alone when she said, "It's not a nice thing to be singing. Have you stopped to think what it's about?" I hadn't, actually. It seemed mostly nonsense rhyme. But when I ran it back through my head, I saw the rather obvious sexual innuendo. "I do. I didn't think about it before." Her expression grew a little gentler, and she reached down to smooth my hair. "Always think about what you're singing, honey." I seemed to be out of trouble, but I couldn't keep from asking, "How is it any different than parts of For All His Waiting, like when Fane asks Lady Periel about her hat? I heard about it from so many men, I wished to see it for myself and try the fit. It's pretty obvious what he's really talking about." I watched her mouth grow firm, not angry, but not pleased. Then something in her face changed. "You tell me what the difference is," she said. I hated bait questions. The difference was obvious. One would get me in trouble, the other wouldn't.
I waited a while to make it clear I had given the matter proper consideration before I shook my head. My mother knelt lightly in front of the fire, warming her hands. "The difference is... Go fetch me the tripod, would you?" She gave me a gentle push, and I scampered off to get it from the back of our wagon as she continued. "The difference is between saying something to a person and saying something about a person. The first might be rude, but the second is always gossip." I brought the tripod back and helped her set it over the fire. "Also, Lady Periel is just a character. Lady Lackless is a real person with feelings that can be hurt." She looked up at me. "I didn't know," I protested guiltily. I must have struck a sufficiently piteous figure because she gathered me in for a hug and a kiss. "It's nothing to cry over, sweet one. Just remember to always think about what you're doing." She ran her hand over my head and smiled like the sun. "I imagine you could make it up to both Lady Lackless and myself if you found some sweet nettle for the pot tonight." Any excuse to escape judgment and play for a while in the tangle of trees by the roadside was good enough for me. I was gone almost before the words left her mouth. I should also make it clear that much of the time I spent with Ben was my free time. I was still responsible for my normal duties in the troop. I acted the part of the young page when needed. I helped paint scenery and sew costumes. I rubbed down the horses at night and rattled the sheet of tin backstage when we needed thunder on stage. But I didn't bemoan the loss of my free time. A child's endless energy and my own insatiable lust for knowledge made the following year one of the happiest times I can remember. Chapter 12. Puzzle Pieces Fitting. Toward the end of the summer, I accidentally overheard a conversation that shook me out of my state of blissful ignorance. When we are children, we seldom think of the future. This innocence leaves us free to enjoy ourselves as few adults can. The day we fret about the future is the day we leave our childhood behind. It was evening, and the troop was camped by the side of the road. Abinthy had given me a new piece of sympathy to practice. The maxim of variable heat transferred to constant motion, or something pretentious like that. It was tricky, but it had fallen into place like a puzzle piece fitting. It had taken about 15 minutes, and from Abinthy's tone, I guessed he had expected it to take 3 or 4 hours at least. So I went looking for him, partly to get my next lesson, and partly so that I could be just a little bit smug. I tracked him down to my parents' wagon. I heard the three of them long before I saw them. Their voices were just murmurs, the distant music that a conversation makes when it's too dim for words. But as I was coming close, I heard one word clearly. Chandrian. I pulled up short when I heard that. Everyone in the troop knew my father was working on a song. He'd been teasing old stories and rhymes from townsfolk for over a year wherever we stopped to play. For months, it was stories about Lanry. Then he started gathering old fairy stories, too, legends about bogies and shamblemen. Then he began to ask questions about the Chandrian. That was months ago. Over the last half year, he had asked more about the Chandrian and less about Lanry, Lyra, and the rest. Most songs my father set to writing were finished in a single season, while this one was stretching toward its second year. You should know this as well. My father never let word or whisper of a song be heard before it was ready to play. Only my mother was allowed into his confidence, as her hand was always in any song he made. The cleverness in the music was his. The best words were hers. When you wait a few span or month to hear a finished song, the anticipation adds savor. But after a year, excitement begins to sour. By now, a year and a half had passed, and folk were almost mad with curiosity. This occasionally led to hard words when someone was caught wandering a little too close to our wagon while my father and mother were working. So I moved closer to my parents' fire, stepping softly. Eavesdropping is a deplorable habit, but I have developed worse ones since.
much about them, I heard Ben say, but I'm willing. I'm glad to talk with an educated man on the subject. My father's strong baritone was a contrast to Ben's tenor. I'm weary of these superstitious country folk and the... Someone added wood to the fire, and I lost my father's words in the crackling that followed. Stepping as quickly as I dared, I moved into the long shadow of my parents' wagon. Like I'm chasing ghosts with this song, trying to piece together this story is a fool's game. I wish I'd never started it.
Nonsense, my mother said. This will be your best work, and you know it.
So, you think there is an original story all the others stem from? Ben asked. A historical basis for Lanre?
All the signs point to it, my father said. It's like looking at a dozen grandchildren and seeing 10 of them have blue eyes. You know the grandmother had blue eyes, too. I've done this before. I'm good at it. I wrote Below the Walls the same way, but... I heard him sigh.
What's the problem, then?
The story's older, my mother explained. It's more like he's looking at great-great-grandchildren.
And they're scattered to the four corners, my father groused. And, when I finally do find one, it's got 5 eyes. 2 greens, a blue, a brown, and a chartreuse. Then the next one has only 1 eye, and it changes colors. How am I supposed to draw conclusions from that?
Ben cleared his throat.
A disturbing analogy, he said. But you're welcome to pick my brain about the Chandrian. I've heard a lot of stories over the years.
The first thing I need to know is how many there actually are, my father said. Most stories say 7, but even that's conflicted. Some say 3, others 5, and in Felior's Fall, there are a full 13 of them, one for each pontifex in Aetur, and an extra for the capital.
That I can answer, Ben said. 7. You can hold to that with some certainty. It's part of their name, actually. Chaon means 7. Chaondian means 7 of them. Chandrian.
I didn't know that, my father said. Chaon. What language is that? Yilish?
Sounds like Tema, my mother said.
You've got a good ear, Ben said to her. It's Temic, actually. Predates Tema by about 1,000 years.
Well, that simplifies things, I heard my father say. I wish I'd asked you a month ago. I don't suppose you know why they do what they do.
I could tell by my father's tone that he didn't really expect an answer.
That's the real mystery, isn't it? Ben chuckled. I think that's what makes them more frightening than the rest of the bogeymen you hear about in stories. A ghost wants revenge. A demon wants your soul. A shambleman is hungry and cold. It makes them less terrible. Things we understand we can try to control. But Chandrian come like lightning from a clear blue sky. Just destruction. No rhyme or reason to it.
My song will have both, my father said with grim determination. I think I've dug up their reason, after all this while. I've teased it together from bits and pieces of story. That's what's so galling about all this, to have the harder part of this done and have all these small specifics giving me such trouble.
You think you know? Ben said curiously. What's your theory?
My father gave a low chuckle. Oh, no, Ben. You'll have to wait with the others. I've sweated too long over this song to give away the heart of it before it's finished.
I could hear the disappointment in Ben's voice.
I'm sure this is all just an elaborate ruse to keep me traveling with you, he groused. I won't be able to leave until I've heard the blackened thing.
Then help us finish it, my mother said. The Chandrian signs are another key piece of information we can't nail down. Everyone agrees there are signs that warn of their presence,
but nobody agrees on what they are.
Let me think, Ben said. Blue flame is obvious, of course, but I'd hesitate to attribute that to the Chandrian in particular. In some stories, it's a sign of demons. In others, it's fey creatures or magic of any sort.
It shows bad air in mines, too, my mother pointed out.
Does it?
My father asked. She nodded. When a lamp burns with a blue haze, you know there's fire damp in the air.
Good Lord, fire damp in a coal mine, my father said. Blow out your light and get lost in the black, or leave it burn and blow the whole place to flinders. That's more frightening than any demon. I'll also admit to the fact that certain arcanists occasionally use prepared candles or torches to impress gullible townsfolk, Ben said, clearing his throat self-consciously.
My mother laughed. Remember who you're talking to, Ben. We'd never hold a little showmanship against a man. In fact, blue candles would be just the thing the next time we play Deonica. If you ever happen to find a couple tucked away somewhere, that is.
I'll see what I can do, Ben said, his voice amused. Other signs. One of them is supposed to have eyes like a goat, or no eyes, or black eyes. I've heard that one quite a bit. I've heard that plants die when the Chandrian are around. Wood rots, metal rusts, brick crumbles. He paused. Though I don't know if that's several signs or all one sign.
You begin to see the trouble I'm having, my father said morosely. And there's still the question as to if they all share the same signs or have a couple each.
I've told you, my mother said exasperated. One sign for each of them. It makes the most sense.
My lady wife's favorite theory, my father said. But it doesn't fit. In some stories, the only sign is blue flame. In others, you have animals going crazy and no blue flame. In others, you have a man with black eyes and animals going mad and blue flame.
I've told you how to make sense of that, she said, her irritated tone indicating that they'd had this particular discussion before. They don't always have to be together. They could go out in threes or fours. If one of them makes fires dim, then it'll look the same as if they all made the fires dim. That would account for the differences in the stories. Different numbers and different signs depending upon how they're grouped together. My father grumbled something.
That's a clever wife you've got there, Arl.
Ben spoke up, breaking the tension.
How much will you sell her for?
I need her for my work, unfortunately. But if you're interested in a short-term rental, I'm sure we could arrange a
There was a fleshy thump followed by a slightly pained chortle in my father's baritone.
Any other signs that spring to mind?
They're supposed to be cold to the touch, though how anyone could know that is beyond me. I've heard that fires don't burn around them, though that directly contradicts the blue flame. It could...
The wind picked up, stirring the trees. The rustling leaves drowned out what Ben said. I took advantage of the noise to creep a few steps closer.
Being yoked to shadow, whatever that means,
I heard my father say as the wind died down. Ben grunted.
I couldn't say either. I heard a story where they were given away because their shadows pointed the wrong way, toward the light. And there was another where one of them was referred to as Shadowhamed. It was something the Shadowhamed. Damned if I can remember the name, though.
Speaking of names, that's another point I'm having trouble with, my father said. There are a couple dozen I've collected that I'd appreciate your opinion on. The most...
Actually, Arl, Ben interrupted, I'd appreciate it if you didn't say them out loud. Names of people, that is. You can scratch them in the dirt if you'd like, or I could go fetch a slate... But I'd be more comfortable if you didn't actually say any of them. Better safe than sore, as they say.
There was a deep piece of silence. I stopped mid-sneak,
with one foot off the ground, afraid they'd heard me.
"Now don't go looking at me like that, either of you," Ben said testily.
"We're just surprised, Ben," came my mother's gentle voice. "You don't seem the superstitious type."
"I'm not," Ben said. "I'm careful. There's a difference."
"Of course," my father said. "I'd never—"
"Save it for the paying customers, Arl,"
Ben cut him off, irritation plain in his voice.
"You're too good an actor to show it, but I know perfectly well when someone thinks I'm daft."
"I just didn't expect it, Ben," my father said apologetically. "You're educated, and I'm so tired of people touching iron and tipping their beer as soon as I mention the Chandrian. I'm just reconstructing a story, not meddling with dark arts."
"Well, hear me out. I like both of you too well to let you think of me as an old fool," Ben said. "Besides, I have something to talk with you about later, and I'll need you to take me seriously for that."
The wind continued to pick up, and I used the noise to cover my last few steps. I edged around the corner of my parents' wagon and peered through a veil of leaves. The three of them were sitting around the campfire. Ben was sitting on a stump, huddled in his frayed brown cloak. My parents were opposite him, my mother leaning against my father, a blanket draped loosely around them. Ben poured from a clay jug into a leather mug and handed it to my mother. His breath fogged as he spoke.
"How do they feel about demons off in Etor?" he asked.
"Scared."
My father tapped his temple.
"All that religion makes their brains soft."
"How about off in Vintas?" Ben asked. "Fair number of them are Talons. Do they feel the same way?"
My mother shook her head. "They think it's a little silly. They like their demons metaphorical."
"What are they afraid of at night in Vintas, then?"
"The Fae," my mother said. My father spoke at the same time.
"Draugr. You're both right, depending upon which part of the country you're in," Ben said. "And here in the Commonwealth, people laugh up their sleeves at both ideas."
He gestured at the surrounding trees.
"But here, they're careful come autumn time for fear of drawing the attention of shamble men."
"That's the way of things," my father said. "Half of being a good trooper is knowing which way your audience leans."
"You still think I've gone cracked in the head?" Ben said, amused. "Listen. If tomorrow we pulled into Beeren and someone told you there were shamble men in the woods, would you believe them?"
My father shook his head.
"What if two people told you?"
Another shake. Ben leaned forward on his stump.
"What if a dozen people told you with perfect earnestness that shamble men were out in the fields eating?"
"Of course I wouldn't believe them," my father said, irritated. "It's ridiculous."
"Of course it is," Ben agreed, raising a finger. "But the real question is this. Would you go into the woods?"
My father sat very still and thoughtful for a moment. Ben nodded.
"You'd be a fool to ignore half the town's warning, even though you don't believe the same thing they do. If not shamble men, what are you afraid of?"
"Bears."
"Bandits."
"Good, sensible fears for a trooper to have," Ben said. "Fears that townfolk don't appreciate. Every place has its little superstitions, and everyone laughs at what the folk across the river think."
He gave them a serious look.
"But have either of you ever heard a humorous song or story about the Chandrian?" "I'll bet a penny you haven't."
My mother shook her head after a moment's thought. My father took a long drink before joining her.
"Now I'm not saying that the Chandrian are out there, striking like lightning from the clear blue sky, but folk everywhere are afraid of them. There's usually a reason for that."
Ben grinned and tipped his clay cup, pouring the last drizzle of beer out onto the earth.
"And names are strange things, dangerous things."
He gave them a pointed look.
"That I know for true, because I am an educated man."
If I'm a mite superstitious, too. He shrugged. Well, that's my choice. I'm old. You have to humor me.
My father nodded thoughtfully. It's odd I never noticed that everyone treats the Chandrian the same. It's something I should have seen.
He shook his head as if to clear it.
We can come back to names later, I suppose. What was it you wanted to talk about?
I prepared to sneak off before I was caught. But what Ben said next froze me in place before I took a single step.
It's probably hard to see, being his parents and all, but your young Quoth is rather bright.
Ben refilled his cup and held out the jug to my father, who declined it.
As a matter of fact, bright doesn't begin to cover it. Not by half.
My mother watched Ben over the top of her mug. Anyone who spends a little time with the boy can see that, Ben. I don't see why anyone would make a point of it. Least of all you.
I don't think you really grasp the situation, Ben said, stretching his feet almost into the fire. How easily did he pick up the loot?
My father seemed a little surprised by the sudden change of topic.
Fairly easily. Why?
How old was he?
My father tugged thoughtfully at his beard for a moment. In the silence, my mother's voice was like a flute. 8.
Think back to when you learned to play. Can you remember how old you were? Can you remember the sort of difficulties you had?
My father continued to tug on his beard, but his face was more reflective now, his eyes far away. Abinthy continued.
I'll bet he learned each chord, each fingering, after being shown just once. No stumbling, no complaining. And when he did make a mistake, it was never more than once, right?
My father seemed a little perturbed.
Mostly. But he did have trouble, just the same as anyone else. E chord. He had a lot of trouble with greater and diminished E.
My mother broke in softly. I remember too, dear, but I think it was just his small hands. He was awfully young.
I bet it didn't stall him for long, Ben said quietly. He does have marvelous hands. My mother would have called them magician's fingers.
My father smiled.
He gets them from his mother. Delicate but strong. Perfect for scrubbing pots, eh, woman?
My mother swatted him, then caught one of his hands in her own and unfolded it for Ben to see. He gets them from his father. Graceful and gentle. Perfect for seducing young nobles' daughters. My father started to protest, but she ignored him. With his eyes and those hands, there won't be a woman safe in all the world when he starts hunting after the ladies.
Courting, dear,
my father corrected gently. Semantics, she shrugged. It's all a chase, and when the race is done, I think I pity women chased who run. She leaned back against my father, keeping his hand in her lap. She tilted her head slightly, and he took his cue, leaning in to kiss the corner of her mouth.
Amen, Ben said, raising his mug in salute.
My father put his other arm around her and gave her a squeeze.
I still don't see what you're getting at, Ben.
He does everything that way. Quick as a whip, hardly ever makes mistakes. I'll bet he knows every song you've ever sung to him. He knows more about what's in my wagon than I do.
He picked up the jug and uncorked it.
It's not just memorization, though.
He understands.
Half the things I've been meaning to show him, he's already figured out for himself.
Ben refilled my mother's cup.
He's 11. Have you ever known a boy his age who talks the way he does? A great deal of it comes from living in such an enlightened atmosphere.
Ben gestured to the wagons.
But most 11-year-olds' deepest thoughts have to do with skipping stones and how to swing a cat by the tail.
My mother laughed like bells, but Abinthy's face was serious.
It's true, lady. I've had older students that would have loved to do half as well.
He grinned. If I had his hands and one quarter his wit, I'd be eating off silver plates inside a year.
There was a lull. My mother spoke softly. I remember when he was just a little baby toddling around, watching, always watching, with clear, bright eyes that looked like they wanted to swallow up the world. Her voice had a little quaver in it. My father put his arm around her and she rested her head on his chest. The next silence was longer. I was considering sneaking away when my father broke it.
"What is it you suggest we do?"
His voice was a mix of mild concern and fatherly pride. Ben smiled gently.
"Nothing, except to think about what options you might give him when the time comes. He will leave his mark on the world as one of the best."
"The best what?" my father rumbled.
"Whatever he chooses. If he stays here, I don't doubt he will become the next Ilion."
My father smiled. Ilion is the trooper's hero. The only truly famous Edimaru in all of history. All our oldest, best songs are his songs. What's more, if you believe the stories, Ilion reinvented the lute in his lifetime. A master luthier, Ilion transformed the archaic, fragile, unwieldy court lute into the marvelous, versatile, seven-string trooper's lute we use today. The same stories claim Ilion's own lute had eight strings in all.
"Ilion. I like that thought," my mother said. "Kings coming from miles away to hear my little Kvothe play."
"His music stopping barroom brawls and border wars," Ben smiled. "The wild women in his lap," my father enthused, "laying their breasts on his head."
There was a moment of stunned silence. Then my mother spoke slowly, with an edge to her voice.
"I think you mean wild beasts laying their heads in his lap."
"Do I?"
Ben coughed and continued.
"If he decides to become an arcanist, I bet he'll have a royal appointment by the time he's 24. If he gets it into his head to be a merchant, I don't doubt he'll own half the world by the time he dies."
My father's brows knitted together. Ben smiled and said,
"Don't worry about the last one. He's too curious for a merchant."
Ben paused as if considering his next words very carefully.
"He'd be accepted into the university, you know. Not for years, of course. 17 is about as young as they go. But I have no doubts about..."
I missed the rest of what Ben said. The university. I had come to think of it in the same way most children think of the Fey Court, a mythical place reserved for dreaming about. A school the size of a small town, 10 times 10,000 books, people who would know the answers to any question I could ever ask. It was quiet when I turned my attention back to them. My father was looking down at my mother, nestled under his arm.
"How about it, woman? Did you happen to bed down with some wandering god a dozen years ago? That might solve our little mystery."
She swatted at him playfully, and a thoughtful look crossed her face. "Come to think of it, there was a night about a dozen years ago. A man came to me. He bound me with kisses and cords of corded song. He robbed me of my virtue and stole me away." She paused. "But he didn't have red hair. Couldn't be him." She smiled wickedly at my father, who appeared a little embarrassed. Then she kissed him. He kissed her back. That's how I like to remember them today. I snuck away with thoughts of the university dancing in my head.
Chapter 13. Interlude. Flesh with Blood Beneath. In the Waystone Inn, there was a silence. It surrounded the two men sitting at a table in an otherwise empty room. Kvothe had stopped speaking, and while he seemed to be staring down at his folded hands, in reality, his eyes were far away. When he finally pulled his gaze upward, he seemed almost surprised to find Chronicler sitting across the table, pen poised above his inkwell. Kvothe let out his breath self-consciously and motioned Chronicler to set down his pen. After a moment, Chronicler complied, wiping the nib of the pen on a clean cloth before setting it down.
"I could use a drink," Kvothe announced suddenly, as if he were surprised. "I haven't told many stories lately, and I find myself unreasonably dry."
He rose smoothly from the table and began to make his way through the maze of empty tables toward the empty bar.
"I can offer you almost anything. Dark ale, pale wine, spiced cider, chocolate, coffee."
Chronicler raised an eyebrow.
"Chocolate would be wonderful, if you have it. I wouldn't expect to find that sort of thing this far from..."
He cleared his throat politely. "Well, anywhere."
"We have everything here at the Waystone," Kvothe said, making an offhand gesture to the empty room. "Excepting any customers, of course."
He brought an earthenware jug up from underneath the bar, then set it on the bar with a hollow sound. He sighed before calling out,
"Bast! Bring up some cider, would you?"
An indistinct reply echoed from a doorway at the back of the room.
"Bast!"
Kvothe chided, seemingly too quiet to be heard.
"Shag down here and get it yourself, you hack!"
the voice shouted up from the basement.
"I'm in the middle of something!"
"Hired help?" Chronicler asked. Kvothe leaned his elbows on the bar and smiled indulgently. After a moment, the sound of someone climbing a set of wooden stairs in hard-soled boots echoed from the doorway. Bast stepped into the room, muttering under his breath. He was dressed simply. Black long-sleeve shirt tucked into black pants. Black pants tucked into soft black boots. His face was sharp and delicate, almost beautiful, with striking blue eyes. He carried a jug to the bar, walking with a strange and not unpleasant grace.
"One customer?"
he said reproachfully.
"You couldn't get it yourself. You pulled me away from Selim Tintur. You've been harping on me to read it for nearly a month now."
"Bast, do you know what they do to students at the university who eavesdrop on their teachers?" Kvothe asked archly. Bast put a hand on his chest and began to protest his innocence.
"Bast?"
Kvothe gave him a stern look. Bast closed his mouth and for a moment looked as if he were about to try and offer some explanation, and then his shoulders slumped.
"How did you know?"
Kvothe chuckled. "You've been avoiding that book for a mortal age. Either you had suddenly become an exceptionally dedicated student, or you were doing something incriminating."
"What do they do to students at the university who eavesdrop?"
Bast asked curiously.
"I haven't the slightest idea. I was never caught. I think making you sit and listen to the rest of my story should be punishment enough. But I forget myself," Kvothe said, gesturing to the common room. "We are neglecting our guest."
Chronicler seemed anything but bored. As soon as Bast entered the room, Chronicler began to watch him curiously. As the conversation continued, Chronicler's expression had grown by degrees more puzzled and more intent. In fairness, something ought to be said about Bast. At first glance, he looked to be an average, if attractive, young man. But there was something different about him. For instance, he wore soft black leather boots. At least, if you looked at him, that's what you saw. But if you happened to catch a glimpse of him from the corner of your eye, and if he were standing in the right type of shadow, you might see something else entirely. And if you had the right sort of mind, the sort of mind that actually sees what it looks at, you might notice that his eyes were odd. If your mind had the rare talent of not being fooled by its own expectations, you might notice something else about them, something strange and wonderful. Because of this, Chronicler had been staring at Kvothe's young student, trying to decide what was different about him. By the time their conversation was through, Chronicler's gaze would be considered intense at the very least, and rude by most. When Bast finally turned from the bar, Chronicler's eyes widened perceptibly, and the color drained from his already pale face. Chronicler reached inside his shirt and tugged something from around his neck. He
He set it on the table at arm's length between himself and Bast. All this was done in half a second, and his eyes never left the dark-haired young man at the bar. Chronicler's face was calm as he pressed the metal disc firmly onto the table with two fingers.
"Iron," he said, his voice sounding with strange resonance, as if it were an order to be obeyed.
Bast doubled over as if punched in the stomach, baring his teeth and making a noise halfway between a growl and a scream. Moving with an unnatural, sinuous speed, he drew one hand back to the side of his head and tensed himself to spring. It all happened in the time it takes to draw a sharp breath. Still, somehow, Kvolf's long-fingered hand caught Bast's wrist. Unaware or uncaring, Bast leaped toward Chronicler only to be brought up short, as if Kvolf's hand were a shackle. Bast struggled furiously to free himself, but Kvolf stood behind the bar, arm outstretched, motionless as steel or stone.
"Stop!"
Kvolf's voice struck the air like a commandment, and in the stillness that followed, his words were sharp and angry.
"I will have no fighting among my friends. I have lost enough without that."
His eyes caught Chronicler.
"Undo that, or I will break it."
Chronicler paused, shaken. Then his mouth moved silently, and with a slight tremor, he drew his hand away from the circle of dull metal that lay upon the table. Tension poured out of Bast, and for a moment he hung limply as a rag doll from the wrist Kvolf still held, standing behind the bar. Shakily, Bast managed to find his feet and lean against the bar. Kvolf gave him a long, searching look, then released his wrist. Bast slumped onto the stool without taking his eyes from Chronicler. He moved gingerly, like a man with a tender wound. And he had changed. The eyes that watched Chronicler were still a striking ocean blue, but now they showed themselves to be all one color, like gems or deep forest pools, and his soft leather boots had been replaced with graceful cloven hooves. Kvothe motioned Chronicler forward imperiously, then turned to grab two thick glasses and a bottle seemingly at random. He set the glasses down as Bast and Chronicler eyed each other uneasily.
"Now," Kvothe said angrily, "you've both acted understandably, but that does not by any means mean that either of you has behaved well. So we might as well start over all together."
He drew a deep breath.
"Bast, let me introduce you to Devon Lockheys, also known as Chronicler. By all accounts, a great teller, rememberer, and recorder of stories. In addition, unless I have suddenly lost all my wit, an accomplished member of the Arcanum, and at least Ralar, and one of perhaps 20 people in the world who knows the name of Iron. However," Kvothe continued, "in spite of these accolades, he seems to be a bit innocent of the ways of the world, as demonstrated by his plentiful lack of wit in making a near-suicidal attack on what I guess is the first of the folk he has ever had the luck to see." Chronicler stood impassively throughout the introduction, watching Bast as if he were a snake.
"Chronicler, I would like you to meet Bastus, son of Remen, Prince of Twilight and the Telwith Male, the brightest, which is to say the only student I've had the misfortune to teach, glamourer, bartender, and, not last, my friend, who, over the course of 150 years of life, not to mention nearly 2 years of my personal tutelage, has managed to avoid learning a few important facts, the first being this. Attacking a member of the Arcanum skilled enough to make a binding of iron is foolish."
"He attacked me!" said Bast hotly.
Kvothe looked at him coolly. "I didn't say it was unjustified. I said it was foolish.
I would have won."
"Very likely. But you would have been hurt, and he would be hurt or dead. You remember that I had introduced him as my guest?" Bast was silent. His expression remained belligerent.
"Now," said Kvothe, with a brittle cheerfulness, "you've been introduced."
"Pleased," Bast said icily.
"Likewise," Chronicler returned.
"There is no reason for you two to be anything other than friends," Quoth continued, an edge creeping into his voice. "And that is not how friends greet each other." Bast and Chronicler stared at each other. Neither moved. Quoth's voice grew quiet. "If you do not stop this foolishness, you may both leave now. One of you will be left with a slim sliver of a story, and the other can search out a new teacher. If there is one thing I will not abide, it is the folly of a willful pride." Something about the low intensity of Quoth's voice broke the stare between them, and when they turned to look at him, it seemed that someone very different was standing behind the bar. The jovial innkeeper was gone, and in his place stood someone dark and fierce. "He's so young," Chronicler marveled. "He can't be more than 25. Why didn't I see it before? He could break me in his hands like a kindling stick. How did I ever mistake him for an innkeeper, even for a moment?" Then he saw Kvolf's eyes. They had deepened to a green so dark they were nearly black. "This is who I came to see," Chronicler thought to himself. "This is the man who counseled kings and walked old roads with nothing but his wit to guide him. This is the man whose name has become both praise and curse at the university." Quoth stared at Chronicler and Bast in turn. Neither could meet his eye for very long. After an awkward pause, Bast extended his hand. Chronicler hesitated for a bare moment before reaching out quickly, as if he were sticking his hand into a fire. Nothing happened. Both of them seemed moderately surprised. "Amazing, isn't it?" Quoth addressed them bitingly. "Five fingers and flesh with blood beneath. One could almost believe that on the other end of that hand lay a person of some sort." Guilt crept into the expressions of the two men. They let go of each other's hands. Quoth poured something from the green bottle into the glasses. This simple gesture changed him. He seemed to fade back into himself, until there was little left of the dark-eyed man who stood behind the bar a moment ago. Chronicler felt a pang of loss as he stared at the innkeeper with one hand hidden in a linen rag. "Now," Quoth pushed the glasses toward them, "take these drinks, sit at that table, and talk. When I come back, I don't want to find either one of you dead or the building on fire. Fair?" Bast gave an embarrassed smile as Chronicler picked up the glasses and moved back to the table. Bast followed him and almost sat down before returning to grab the bottle, too. "Not too much of that," Quoth cautioned as he stepped into the back room. "I don't want you giggling through my story." The two at the table began a tense, halting conversation as Quoth moved into the kitchen. Several minutes later, he emerged, bringing out cheese and a loaf of dark bread, cold chicken and sausage, butter and honey. They moved to a larger table as Quoth brought the platters out, bustling about and looking every bit the innkeeper. Chronicler watched him covertly, finding it hard to believe that this man humming to himself and cutting sausage could be the same person who had stood behind the bar just minutes ago, dark-eyed and terrible. As Chronicler gathered his paper and quills, Quoth studied the angle of the sun through the window, a pensive look on his face. Eventually, he turned to Bast. "How much did you manage to overhear?" "Most of it, Reshi," Bast smiled. "I have good ears." "That's good. We don't have time to backtrack." He drew a deep breath. "Let's get back to it, then. Brace yourselves. The story takes a turn now. Downward. Darker. Clouds on the horizon." Chapter 14. The Name of the Wind. Winter is a slow time of year for a traveling troop, but Abinthy put it to good use and finally got around to teaching me sympathy in earnest. However, as is often the case, especially for children, the anticipation proved much more exciting than the reality. It would be wrong to say that I was disappointed with sympathy, but honestly, I was disappointed It was not what I expected magic to be. It was useful, there was no denying that. Ben used sympathy to make light for our shows. Sympathy could start a fire without flint or lift a heavy weight without cumbersome ropes and pulleys. But the first time I'd seen him, Ben had somehow called the wind. That was no mere sympathy. That was storybook magic. That was the secret I wanted more than anything. Spring thaw was well behind us, and the troop was riding through the forests and fields of the Western Commonwealth. I was riding along, as per normal, in the front of Ben's wagon. Summer was just deciding to make itself known again, and everything was green and growing. Things had been quiet for about an hour. Ben was drowsing with the reins held loosely in one hand when the wagon hit a stone and jarred us both out of our respective reveries. Ben pulled himself more upright in his seat and addressed me in a tone I had grown to think of as, "Have I got a puzzle for you?" "How would you bring a kettle of water to a boil?" Looking around, I saw a large boulder by the side of the road. I pointed. "That stone should be warm from sitting in the sun. I'd bind it to the water in the kettle and use the heat in the stone to bring the water to boil."
"Stone to water isn't very efficient," Ben chided me. "Only about 1 part in 15 would end up warming the water."
"It would work."
"I'll grant you that, but it's sloppy. You can do better, Ilir."
He then proceeded to shout at Alpha and Beta, a sign that he was in a genuine good mood. They took it as calmly as ever, in spite of the fact that he accused them of things I'm sure no donkey has ever willingly done, especially not Beta, who possessed impeccable moral character. Stopping mid-tirade, he asked,
"How would you bring down that bird?"
He gestured to a hawk riding the air above a wheat field to the side of the road.
"I probably wouldn't. It's done nothing to me."
"Hypothetically."
"I'm saying that hypothetically I wouldn't do it."
Ben chuckled.
"Point made, Ilir. Precisely how wouldn't you do it? Details, please."
"I'd get Terran to shoot it down."
He nodded thoughtfully.
"Good, good. However, it's a matter between you and the bird. That hawk," he gestured indignantly, "has said something uncouth about your mother."
"Ah,
then my honor demands I defend her good name myself."
"Indeed it does."
"Do I have a feather?"
"No."
"Talu, hold and—"
I bit off the rest of what I was going to say at his disapproving look.
"You never make it easy, do you?"
"It's an annoying habit I picked up from a student who was too clever for his own good," he smiled. "What could you do even if you had a feather?"
"I'd bind it to the bird and lather it with lye soap."
Ben furrowed his brow, such as it was.
"What kind of binding?"
"Chemical. Probably second catalytic."
A thoughtful pause.
"Second catalytic?" He scratched at his chin. "To dissolve the oil that makes the feather smooth?"
I nodded. He looked up at the bird.
"I've never thought of that,"
he said with a kind of quiet admiration. I took it as a compliment.
"Nevertheless," he looked back to me, "you have no feather. How do you bring it down?"
I thought for several minutes, but couldn't think of anything. I decided to try and turn this into a different sort of lesson. "I would," I said casually, "simply call the wind and make it strike the bird from the sky." Ben gave me a calculating look that told me he knew exactly what I was up to.
"And how would you do that, Ilir?"
I sensed he might be ready to finally tell me the secret he had been keeping all through the winter months. At the same time, I was struck with an idea. I drew in a deep breath and spoke the words to bind the air in my lungs to the air outside. I fixed the ailer firmly in my mind, put my thumb and forefinger in front of my pursed lips, and blew between them.
There was a light puff of wind at my back that tousled my hair and caused the tarpaulin covering the wagon to pull taut for a moment. It might have been nothing more than a coincidence, but nevertheless, I felt an exultant smile overflow my face. For a second, I did nothing but grin like a maniac at Ben, his face dull with disbelief. Then, I felt something squeeze my chest, as if I was deep underwater. I tried to draw a breath, but couldn't. Mildly confused, I kept trying. It felt as if I'd just fallen flat on my back and had the air driven from me. All in a rush, I realized what I had done. My body exploded into a cold sweat, and I grabbed frantically at Ben's shirt, pointing at my chest, my neck, my open mouth. Ben's face turned from shock to ashen as he looked at me. I realized how still everything was. Not a blade of grass was stirring. Even the sound of the wagon seemed muted, as if far off in the distance. Terror screamed through my mind, drowning out any thought. I began to claw at my throat, ripping my shirt open. My heart thundered through the ringing in my ears. Pain stabbed through my straining chest as I gaped for air. Moving more quickly than I had ever seen before, Ben grabbed me by the tatters of my shirt and sprang from the seat of the wagon. Landing in the grass by the side of the road, he dashed me to the ground with such a force that if I'd had any air in my lungs, it would have been driven out of me. Tears streaked my face as I thrashed blindly. I knew that I was going to die. My eyes felt hot and red. I raked madly at the earth with hands that were numb and cold as ice. I was aware of someone shouting, but it seemed very far away. Ben kneeled above me, but the sky was getting dim behind him. He seemed almost distracted, as if he were listening to something I couldn't hear. Then he looked at me. All I remember were his eyes. They seemed far away and filled with a terrible power, dispassionate and cold. He looked at me. His mouth moved. He called the wind. A leaf in lightning, I shook, and the thunderclap was black. The next thing I remember was Ben helping me to my feet. I was dimly aware of the other wagons stopping and curious faces peering at us. My mother came away from our wagon and Ben met her halfway, chuckling and saying something reassuring. I couldn't make out the words as I was focused on breathing deep, in and out. The other wagons trundled on, and I followed Ben mutely back to his wagon. He made a show of puttering around, checking the cords that held the tarpaulin tight. I collected my wits and was helping as best I could when the final wagon in the troop passed us. When I looked up, Ben's eyes were furious.
"What were you thinking?"
he hissed.
"Well, what? What were you thinking?"
I'd never seen him like this before. His whole body drawn up into a tight knot of anger. He was shaking with it. He drew back his arm to strike me, then stopped. After a moment, his hand fell to his side. Moving methodically, he checked the last couple of ropes and climbed back onto the wagon. Not knowing what else to do, I followed him. Ben twitched the reins and Alpha and Beta tugged the wagon into motion. We were the last in line now. Ben stared straight ahead. I fingered the torn front of my shirt. It was tensely silent. In hindsight, what I had done was glaringly stupid. When I bound my breath to the air outside, it made it impossible for me to breathe. My lungs weren't strong enough to move that much air. I would have needed a chest like an iron bellows. I would have had as much luck trying to drink a river or lift a mountain. We rode for about 2 hours in an uncomfortable silence. The sun was brushing the tops of the trees when Ben finally drew in a deep breath and let it out in an explosive sigh. He handed me the reins. When I looked back at him, I realized for the first time how old he was. I had always known he was nearing his 30 of years, but I'd never seen him look it before.
"I lied to your mother back there, Quoth. She saw the end of what happened and was worried about you."
His eyes didn't move from the wagon ahead of ours as he spoke.
"I told her we were working on something for a performance. She's a good woman. She deserves better than lies."
We rode on in an endless agony of silence. But it was still a few hours before sunset when I heard voices calling, "Greystone!" down the line. The bump of our wagon turning onto the grass jostled Ben from his brooding. He looked around and saw the sun was still in the sky.
"Why are we stopping so early? Tree across the road?"
"Greystone." I gestured up ahead to the slab of stone that loomed over the tops of the wagons ahead of us.
"What?"
"Every once in a while we run across one by the road." I gestured again to the greystone peering over the tops of smaller trees by the roadside. Like most greystones, it was a crudely hewn rectangle about a dozen feet tall. The wagons gathering around it seemed rather insubstantial compared to the stone's solid presence. "I've heard them called standing stones, but I've seen a lot of them that weren't standing, just lying on their sides. We always stop for the day when we find one, unless we're in a terrible hurry." I stopped, realizing I was babbling.
"I've known them by a different name. Waystones," Ben said quietly. He looked old and tired. After a moment, he asked, "Why do you stop when you find one?"
"We just always do. It's a break from the road." I thought for a moment. "I think they're supposed to be good luck." I wished I had more to say to keep the conversation going. His interest piqued, but I couldn't think of anything else.
"I suppose they could be at that."
Ben guided Alpha and Beta into a spot on the far side of the stone, away from most of the other wagons.
"Come back for dinner or soon afterward. We need to talk."
He turned without looking at me and began to unhitch Alpha from the wagon. I'd never seen Ben in a mood like this before. Worried that I'd ruined things between us, I turned and ran to my parents' wagon. I found my mother sitting in front of a fresh fire, slowly adding twigs to build it up. My father sat behind her, rubbing her neck and shoulders. They both looked up at the sound of my feet running toward them.
"Can I eat with Ben tonight?"
My mother looked up at my father, then back to me.
"You shouldn't make yourself a nuisance, dear." "He invited. If I go now, I can help him set up for the night."
She wiggled her shoulders, and my father started rubbing them again. She smiled at me.
"Fair enough. But don't keep him up till the wee hours."
She smiled at me.
"Give me a kiss."
She held out her arms, and I gave her a hug and a kiss. My father gave me a kiss, too.
"Let me have your shirt. It'll give me something to do while your mother fixes dinner."
He skinned me out of it and fingered the torn edges.
"This shirt is holy, holy, more than it has any right to be."
I started to stammer out an explanation, but he waved it aside.
"I know, I know. It was all for the greater good. Try to be more careful, or I'll make you sew it yourself. There's a fresh one in your trunk. Bring me needle and thread while you're in there, if you'd be so kind."
I made a dash into the back of the wagon and drew on a fresh shirt. While I rummaged around for needle and thread, I heard my mother singing. "In evening when the sun is setting fast, I'll watch for you from high above. The time for your return is long since past, but mine is ever faithful love." My father answered,
"In evening when the light is dying, my feet at last are homeward turning. The wind is through the willows sighing. Please keep the hearth fire burning."
When I came out of the wagon, he had her in a dramatic dip and was giving her a kiss. I set the needle and thread next to my shirt and waited. It seemed like a good kiss. I watched with a calculating eye, dimly aware that at some point in the future, I might want to kiss a lady, and if I did, I wanted to do a decent job of it. After a moment, my father noticed me and stood my mother back on her feet.
"That will be a halfpenny for the show, Master Voyer," he laughed. "What are you still here for, boy? I'll bet you the same halfpenny that a question slowed you down."
"Why do we stop for the Greystones?"
"Tradition, my boy," he said grandly, throwing his arms wide, "and superstition.
They are one and the same, anyway. We stop for good luck and because everyone enjoys an unexpected holiday. He paused. I used to know a bit of a poem about them. How did it go? Like a drawstone even in our sleep, standing stone by old road is the way, to lead you ever deeper into fay. Laystone as you lay in hill or dell, graystone leads to something something L. My father stood for a second or two, looking off into space and tugging at his lower lip. Finally, he shook his head. Can't remember the end of that last line. Lord, but I dislike poetry. How can anyone remember words that aren't put to music? His forehead creased with concentration as he mouthed the words silently to himself. What's a drawstone? I asked. It's an old name for lodestones, my mother explained. They're pieces of star iron that draw all other iron toward themselves. I saw one years ago in a curiosity cabinet. She looked up at my father, who was still muttering to himself. We saw the lodestone in Pelerezin, didn't we?
Hmm? What?
The question jogged him out of his reverie. Yes, Pelerezin. He tugged at his lip again and frowned. Remember this, son, if you forget everything else. A poet is a musician who can't sing. Words have to find a man's mind before they can touch his heart, and some men's minds are woeful small targets. Music touches their hearts directly, no matter how small or stubborn the mind of the man who listens. My mother made a slightly unladylike snort. Elitist. You're just getting old. She gave a dramatic sigh. Truly, all the more's the tragedy. The second thing to go is a man's memory. My father puffed up to an indignant pose, but my mother ignored him and said to me, Besides, the only tradition that keeps troops by the graystone is laziness. The poem should run like this. Whatever the season that I'm on the road, I look for a reason, loden or laystone, to lay down my load. My father had a dark glimmer in his eye as he moved behind her.
Old?
He spoke in a low voice as he began to rub her shoulders again. Woman, I have a mind to prove you wrong. She smiled a wry smile. Sir, I have a mind to let you. I decided to leave them to their discussion and started to scamper back to Ben's wagon when I heard my father call out behind me.
Scales after lunch tomorrow, and the second act of Timberton.
Okay, I burst into a jog. When I got back to Ben's wagon, he had already unhitched Alpha and Beta and was rubbing them down. I started to set up the fire, surrounding dry leaves with a pyramid of progressively larger twigs and branches. When I was finished, I turned to where Ben sat. More silence. I could almost see him picking out his words as he spoke.
How much do you know about your father's new song?
The one about Lanray? I asked. Not much. You know what he's like. No one hears it until it's finished. Not even me.
I'm not talking about the song itself, Ben said. The story behind it. Lanray's story.
I thought about the dozens of stories I'd heard my father collect over the last year, trying to pick out the common threads. Lanray was a prince, I said. Or a king, someone important. He wanted to be more powerful than anyone else in the world. He sold his soul for power, but then something went wrong, and afterward I think he went crazy, or he couldn't ever sleep again, or... I stopped when I saw Ben shaking his head.
He didn't sell his soul, Ben said. That's just nonsense.
He heaved a great sigh that seemed to leave him deflated.
I'm doing this all wrong. Never mind your father's song. We'll talk about it after he finishes it. Knowing Lanray's story might give you some perspective.
Ben took a deep breath and tried again.
Suppose you have a thoughtless 6-year-old. What harm can he do?
I paused, unsure what sort of answer he wanted. Straightforward would probably be best.
Not much. Suppose he's 20, and still thoughtless. How dangerous is he? I decided to stick with the obvious answers. Still not much, but more than before. What if you give him a sword? Realization started to dawn on me, and I closed my eyes. More. Much more. I understand, Ben. Really, I do. Power is okay, and stupidity is usually harmless. Power and stupidity together are dangerous. I never said stupid, Ben corrected me. You're clever. We both know that. But you can be thoughtless. A clever, thoughtless person is one of the most terrifying things there is. Worse, I've been teaching you some dangerous things. Ben looked at the fire I'd laid out, then picked up a leaf, mumbled a few words, and watched a small flame flicker into life in the center of the twigs and tinder. He turned to look at me. You could kill yourself doing something as simple as that. He gave a sickly grin. Or looking for the name of the wind. He started to say something else, then stopped and rubbed his face with his hands. He gave a great sigh that seemed to deflate him. When he took his hands away, his face was tired. How old are you again? 12 next month. He shook his head. It's so easy to forget that. You don't act your age. He poked at the fire with a stick. I was 18 when I began at the university, he said. I was 20 before I knew as much as you do now. He stared into the fire. I'm sorry, Kvothe. I need to be alone tonight. I need to do some thinking. I nodded silently. I went to his wagon, gathered tripod and kettle, water and tea. I brought them back and quietly laid them beside Ben. He was still staring into the fire when I turned away. Knowing my parents wouldn't expect me back for a while, I headed into the forest. I had some thinking of my own to do. I owed Ben that much. I wished I could do more. It took a full span of days before Ben was his normal, jovial self again. But even then, things weren't the same between us. We were still fast friends, but there was something between us, and I could tell he was consciously holding himself apart. Lessons ground to a near standstill. He halted my fledgling study of alchemy, limiting me to chemistry instead. He refused to teach me any sigildry at all, and on top of everything else, he began to ration what little sympathy he thought safe for me. I chafed at the delays, but held my peace, trusting that if I showed myself to be responsible and meticulously careful, he would eventually relax and things would return to normal. We were family, and I knew that any trouble between us would eventually be smoothed over. All I needed was time. Little did I know that our time was quickly drawing to an end. Chapter 15. Distractions and Farewells. The town was called Hallowfell. We stopped for a handful of days because there was a good wainwright there, and nearly all our wagons needed tending or mending of some sort. While we were waiting, Ben got the offer he couldn't refuse. She was a widow, fairly wealthy, fairly young, and to my inexperienced eyes, fairly attractive. The official story was that she needed someone to tutor her young son. However, anyone who saw the two of them walking together knew the truth behind that story. She had been the brewer's wife, but he had drowned 2 years ago. She was trying to run the brewery as best she could, but she didn't really have the know-how to do a good job of it. As you can see, I don't think anyone could have built a better snare for Ben if they had tried. Plans were changed and the troop stayed on at Hallowfell for a few extra days. My 12th birthday was moved up and combined with Ben's going-away party. To truly understand what it was like, you must realize that nothing is so grand as a troop showing off for one another. Good entertainers try to make each performance seem special, but you need to remember that the show they're putting on for you is the same one they've put on for hundreds of other audiences. Even the most dedicated troops have an occasional lackluster performance, especially when they know they can get away with it. Small towns, rural inns, those places didn't know good entertainment from bad. Your fellow performers did. Think, then, how do you entertain the people who have seen your act 1,000 times? You dust off the old tricks. You try out some new ones. You hope for the best. And, of course, the grand failures are as entertaining as the great successes. I remember the evening as a wonderful blur of warm emotions, tinged in bitter. Fiddles, lutes, and drums, everyone played and danced and sang as they wished. I dare say we rivaled any fairy revel you can bring to mind. I got presents. Tripp gave me a belt knife with a leather grip, claiming that all boys should have something they can hurt themselves with. Shandy gave me a lovely cloak she had made, scattered with little pockets for a boy's treasures. My parents gave me a lute, a beautiful thing of smooth, dark wood. I had to play a song, of course, and Ben sang with me. I slipped a little on the strings of the unfamiliar instrument, and Ben wandered off looking for notes once or twice, but it was nice. Ben opened up a small keg of mead he had been saving for just such an occasion. I remember it tasting the way I felt, sweet and bitter and sullen. Several people had collaborated to write The Ballad of Ben, Brewer Supreme. My father recited it as gravely as if it were the Modagan royal lineage, while accompanying himself on a half-harp. Everyone laughed until they hurt, and Ben twice as much as everyone else. At some point in the night, my mother swept me up and danced around in a great spinning circle. Her laughter sang out like music trailing in the wind. Her hair and skirt spun around me as she twirled. She smelled comforting, the way only mothers do. That smell and the quick laughing kiss she gave me did more to ease the dull ache of Ben's leaving than all the entertainments combined. Shandy offered to do a special dance for Ben, but only if he came into her tent to see it. I'd never seen Ben blush before, but he did it well. He hesitated, and when he refused, it was obviously about as easy for him as tearing out his own soul. Shandy protested and pouted prettily, saying she'd been practicing it for a long time. Finally, she dragged him into the tent, their disappearance encouraged by a cheer from the entire troop. Tripp and Terran staged a mock sword fight that was one part breathtaking swordplay, one part dramatic soliloquy, provided by Terran, and one part buffoonery that I'm sure Tripp must have invented on the spot. It ranged all over the camp. In the course of the fight, Tripp managed to break his sword, hide under a lady's dress, fence with a sausage, and perform such fantastical acrobatics that it's a miracle he didn't seriously injure himself. Although he did split his pants up the back. Dax set himself alight while attempting a spectacular bit of fire breathing and had to be doused. All he suffered was a bit of singed beard and a slightly bruised pride. He recovered quickly under Ben's tender ministrations, a mug of mead, and a reminder that not everyone was cut out to have eyebrows. My parents sang The Lay of Sir Savian Trelliard. Like most of the great songs, Sir Savian was written by Ilion, and generally considered to be his crowning work. It's a beautiful song, made more so by the fact that I'd only heard my father perform the whole thing a handful of times before. It's hellishly complex, and my father was probably the only one in the troupe who could do it justice. Though he didn't particularly show it, I knew it was taxing even for him. My mother sang the counter harmony, her voice soft and lilting. Even the fire seemed subdued when they took a breath. I felt my heart lift and dive. I wept as much for the glory of the two voices so perfectly enmeshed as for the tragedy of the song. Yes, I cried at the end of it. I did then, and I have every time since. Even a reading of the story aloud will bring tears to my eyes. In my opinion, anyone who isn't moved by it is less than human inside. There was a momentary quiet after they finished, wherein everyone wiped their eyes and blew their noses. Then, after a suitable period of recovery had elapsed, someone called out, "Lanray! Lanray!"
The shout was taken up by several other people. "Yes, Lanray!" My father gave a wry smile and shook his head. He never performed any part of a song until it was finished.
"Come on, Arl," Shandy called out. "You've been stewing it long enough. Let some out of the pot."
He shook his head again, still smiling.
"It's not ready yet."
He bent down and carefully set his lute into its case.
"Let's have a taste, Arladen."
It was Terran this time.
"Yeah, for Ben's sake. It's not fair that he should have to hear you mumble over it for all this while and not get..."
"Are wondering what you're doing in that wagon with your wife if it's not..."
"Sing it! Lanray!"
Trip quickly organized the whole troop into a great chanting, howling mass that my father managed to withstand for almost a minute before he stooped and lifted his lute back out of the case. Everyone cheered. The crowd hushed as soon as he sat back down. He tuned a string or two, even though he'd only just set it down. He flexed his fingers and struck a few soft, experimental notes, then swept into the song so gently that I caught myself listening to it before I knew it had begun. Then my father's voice spoke over the rise and fall of the music. "Sit and listen all, for I will sing a story wrought and forgotten in a time old and gone, a story of a man, proud Lanray, strong as the spring, steel of the sword he had at ready hand. Hear how he fought, fell and rose again, to fall again, under shadow falling then. Love felled him, love for native land, and love of his wife Lyra, at whose calling some say he rose through doors of death to speak her name at his first reborn breath." My father drew a breath and paused, his mouth open as if he would continue. Then a wide, wicked grin spread across his face, and he bent to tuck his lute safely away. There was an outcry and a great deal of complaining, but everyone knew they had been lucky to hear as much as they had. Someone else struck up a song for dancing, and the protests faded away. My parents danced together, her head on his chest. Both had their eyes closed. They seemed so perfectly content. If you can find someone like that, someone who you can hold and close your eyes to the world with, then you're lucky, even if it only lasts for a minute or a day. The image of them gently swaying to the music is how I picture love in my mind, even after all these years. Afterward, Ben danced with my mother, his steps sure and stately. I was struck by how beautiful they looked together. Ben, old, gray and portly, with his lined face and half-burned eyebrows. My mother, slender, fresh and bright, pale and smooth-skinned in the firelight. They complemented each other by contrast. I ached knowing I might never see them together again. By this time the sky was beginning to brighten in the east. Everyone gathered to say their final goodbyes. I can't remember what I said to him before we left. I know it felt woefully inadequate, but I knew he understood. He made me promise not to get myself into any trouble tinkering with the things he had taught me. He stooped a bit and gave me a hug, then tousled my hair. I didn't even mind. In semi-retaliation, I tried to smooth out his eyebrows, something I'd always wanted to try. His expression was marvelous in its surprise. He gathered me into another hug, then he stepped away. My parents promised to steer the troop back toward the town when we were in the area. All the troopers said they wouldn't need much steering, but even as young as I was, I knew the truth. It would be a great long time before I saw him again. Years. I don't remember starting out that morning, but I do remember trying to sleep and feeling quite alone except for a dull, bittersweet ache. When I awoke later in the afternoon, I found a package resting next to me. Wrapped in a sackcloth and tied with twine, there was a bright piece of paper with my name fixed to the top, waving in the wind like a little flag. Unwrapping it, I recognized the book's binding. It was Rhetoric and Logic, the book Ben had used to teach me argument.
Out of his small library of a dozen books, it was the only one I hadn't read from cover to cover. I hated it. I cracked it open and saw writing on the inside cover. It said,
"Quoth, defend yourself well at the university. Make me proud. Remember your father's song. Be wary of folly. Your friend, Abinthy."
Ben and I had never discussed my attending the university. Of course, I had dreams of going there, someday. But they were dreams I hesitated to share with my parents. Attending the university would mean leaving my parents, my troop, everyone and everything I had ever known. Quite frankly, the thought was terrifying. What would it be like to settle in one place, not just for an evening or a span of days, but for months, years? No more performing? No tumbling with Trip or playing the bratty young noble son in Three Pennies for Wishing? No more wagons? No one to sing with? I'd never said anything aloud, but Ben would have guessed. I read his inscription again, cried a bit, and promised him that I would do my best.